This is Richard Barone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. David Hammond. Today is May 2nd, 2006. It's approximately 10:24 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, in the Vietnam Archives interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Dave, you're in Beaverton, Oregon. And before we begin, let's go over the interview agreement that we discussed before we began recording. I need to know if you agree or disagree with what I covered, basically, that you agree to doing this interview on your own accord, that you are aware that this interview will be made public, including putting up on the Internet in the virtual Vietnam Archive, as well as doing the interview is your consent to donate the interview to the archive. Do you agree or disagree, Dave?
I agree.
Okay, great. Well, let's start. I wonder if you could give me a biographical sketch of yourself, where you were born, when you were born, and a bit about your childhood.
Sure. I was born in Cottage Grove, Oregon, August 19th, 1951. Raised close to that in a logging town, primarily in Springfield, Oregon. Graduated, had a normal, pretty normal childhood, middle class family. My father was a city surveyor, and my mother worked kind of part time in town. Went to the public schools, grade school, junior high, high school, and graduated high school in 1969, and from then on, kind of hit the military.
Okay. Tell me about your parents.
Well, both my parents, as of now, are gone. My dad was injured in his younger days. He had a logging company and had actually lost his hand, but that sent him to college from there on out, and he became a surveyor and did well in his life as far as career. Kind of a quiet, nice, everybody liked him type of guy. My mother came from kind of a tougher background from East St. Louis and came out here, at a very young age from East St. Louis and was a homemaker. My parents, though, they did split up when I was, I think I was 12. So I was one of the, it seemed like that was a little different for that age of, there wasn't too many kids that had divorced parents at the time. So, but I think I adjusted well. You know, I lived with my mom from then on and had a stepdad that kept in contact with my dad and saw him, you know, all the time too. So.
How about siblings?
No, I'm an only child.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about Cottage Grove, or you actually were raised in Springfield.
Yeah, I was raised in Springfield. Like, Cottage Grove was just where the hospital was.
Okay.
Springfield, it was a sawmill town, probably 90% or maybe 80% of everybody's parents that I knew, or fathers anyway, worked at the local lumber mills. My dad was one of the few that didn't. I think the population, as I remember when I was younger, was like 17,000. We thought that was, you know, quite a few people, but it wasn't. And it was the kind of town that on a Saturday or during the summer, my buddies and I could get on our Stingray bicycles and grab our fishing poles and pack a lunch and play in the Willamette River and fish and spend all day, and nobody ever really seemed to worry about us. We all did fine.
So. You mentioned... you know, public schools and moving through those. Tell me about education in your family. Was it emphasized, and, you know, how were you as a student?
I was an average student. I think my dad wanted me to go to college because he did, I think, and he knew that would be an advantage. And I think through grade school, I did very well. In fact, I think one was up for student of the year, I think, in fifth grade once. And the junior high, I think I did okay, and then once I got in high school, I did fine. You know, I was what you'd call a C's and B type of student, but I wasn't real interested. I think I went to high school more for the social part of it than just because you were supposed to go to high school. I never had any real ambition at all to go to college. I always in my mind wanted to be self-employed, so that's where I was.
How much of an influence was your father on that as far as, you know, working for yourself?
Not a lot, because he had always worked for someone else, and my mother, when she worked, had always worked for someone else. But I even my high school days, I you know, I'd worked for McDonald's way back when McDonald's, they're on the University of Oregon campus, which is in Eugene, which is just right next door to Springfield. I would work there for a stint, and they would only hire guys, which is, nobody can hardly believe it now, but that was the rule. No girls could work there, just guys. But I happened to know the college kid that was the manager and ended up owning a few stores, and I always thought, boy, if I could just own a McDonald's. So, And after that, about the same time, I'd worked in a gas station that my friend's father owned for a while, and thought, you know, I saw how business worked and how customer service worked, and thought, you know, the way it's going to happen here is going to be self-employed. So that kind of shaped me, I think, from just working experiences.
Were you independent thinking as a child? Did you act independent?
I think so, and I think as an only child, that probably helped some of that. You know, I always had a lot of friends, and I always heard that, you know, oh, you're an only child, you're probably so spoiled. Well, we never had a lot of money. You know, we had plenty. But, you know, I always did okay by myself.
Okay. Tell me about growing up. What kind of person were you? You know, what do you remember, your hobbies and kind of a daily life thing outside of school?
I think some outdoorsy type things. You know, like a lot of kids growing up in the Northwest, we had such a massive amount of things to do as far as fishing and, you know, I used to hunt and camped and, yeah, I just think a lot of everything that had to pertain with outdoors. I can't remember any real specifics, or I didn't have any specific hobbies besides what was going on at that time. You know, we went through a phase in my junior high years when slot cars and slot car tracks were a rage, you know, through the country, and that was big. And I guess I was up in through junior high, all through grade school and junior high, though, fairly active in sports. And so,
which, you know, which sports did you play?
I think mainly track, but through grade school in fifth and sixth grade, when everybody did everything, you played every sport. That was just the way it was. Junior high, I was in track through junior high, and once I hit high school, it was mainly, I think I was destined to change cars about every 3 months and, you know, look for a girlfriend.
Right.
Yeah.
How would you describe yourself socially?
I always thought I was kind of in the middle as far as in the social, when you get through junior high and high school. You know, everybody wanted to be the most popular kid in school, and it probably would never happen. But I think I had friends, you know, the very, very popular kids, or I was always friends to the kids that, you know, weren't. So I always considered myself right in the middle and was nice to everybody.
Okay. You mentioned McDonald's. Did you work anywhere else?
Yes. I spent quite a long time at the local gas station, which was kind of the hot spot for everybody to stop in before they took off on their weekend night. But even in my grades or my younger years, as far as early junior high, I would think, we worked in bean fields, picked strawberries, spent a summer working in a hay field for a farmer. So I always did work. You know, summers we always worked to get money for school clothes, or, you know, and whatever we needed.
When you say we, do you mean you and your friends?
Buddies, yeah.
Okay. Did your parents kind of insist on you working, encourage you to, or
I think so. Oh yeah, that was a given. That's what you were going to do. You know, I think it helped kind of shape me. It's just the way it is, you know. We looked forward to that. We kind of had fun in the younger days of being in the bean and berry fields. I don't think we thought we were having that much fun while we were there. But I look back on it now, and once the summers were over, we would take what money we had, which I don't think amounted to a lot, and get on a bus and take it over to Eugene and buy our school clothes with pennies that was over there. So.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your high school years. What do you remember most about that?
Well, high school, I bounced back. I'd spent almost 2 years at another high school because my mother and stepdad had moved to Central Oregon, which is a place called Redmond, Oregon. But that was a little traumatic, I think, because I started my freshman year with all the people I'd grown up with, my freshman year, and relocated to a, what you'd call more of a cowboy town, which was what Redmond was. And it didn't last forever, but, and I did meet some friends over there, but I can remember when I got there, I think I looked around and I was the only kid in the school that wasn't wearing Wrangler jeans and pearl button shirts and had cowboy boots, because this little town was, had, they just were real different than the Springfield and Eugene area that I was from.
Uh-huh.
So, but didn't do bad there, and then I came back to my original friends in high school about in the middle of my junior year, which was a real easy fit because I'd grown up with everybody and just kind of got right back into it and graduated from that school.
Okay. Tell me about your grades. You mentioned that a bit. What about subjects that you were good in and subjects that you did not like?
I don't think I was actually exceptional in any of them. I had the most trouble with any in biology, and a lot of it, and I think my problem was now, and I think I still might have it, is if I would look at those subjects and look at biology thinking, I don't know why I've got to know how to name, you know, every part of a plant. And there was just no reason at all. And, you know, or even me, it was even algebra, which was a struggle because it, to me it made no sense and why I would ever use it because I would never use it, I never have. You know, and I think, yeah, I guess I, as I remember and I said before, I think I went all through my senior year of high school, and I know I never took one book home or did one bit of homework, but I ended up with C's and B's. So, just, and I think I had no goal as far as going to college, and that probably didn't, you know, didn't help my motivation any at all.
Right, right. Okay. Was there any military experience in your family?
Not very much. I had a... My dad hadn't been in the service. He hit that, there was a window there, I think, right after Korea. There was a few years in there where I know some of my friends' dads hadn't been in either. They were just a little pocket. I forgot what period of time it had been.
Mm-hmm.
But my, I know I had a couple of uncles that were in Vietnam when I was in high school. I'm trying to think, you know, and if you go way back, I had some ancestors in the Civil War, but,
right.
Yeah. And my stepdad had been in World War II, he was in the Navy, so, but other than that, it wasn't a real strong military thing.
Did you talk to your stepdad about his time in the war?
Yes, some, yeah, he'd talk some about it.
Was there any appeal to you at that point to go into the military?
Well, in 1969, there was two choices. You either got a college deferment and went to college, and even at the time, I think there was still a deferment if you hurried up and got married, you didn't have to go in the service, or you went in the service. And in 1969, Vietnam was, you know, really going, and a lot of people were joining the National Guard and Army Reserve just so they wouldn't have to go.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were going to college. So for me, I didn't want to go to school, and the draft was still real heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you know, that military probably makes the most sense, and I didn't know much, you know, any better. So that was kind of my choice. That's kind of how I ended up. You know, I did join the service. It was in 1969, towards the end of our school year, a friend of mine named Curtis Miller and I used to run around together and drag the gut in Eugene and mess with cars and whatnot. And, you know, I'd talk to my stepdad, the one that talked about the Navy enough, and he said, well, if you got to go anywhere, you know, the Navy's always got a bed and this and that, and, you know. And I wasn't real fond of boats and that, but I thought, well, okay. So, I think that friend of mine, Curtis, and I one evening thought, well, if we're not going to school, we might as well join the service and we can go together. So that's kind of we made the decision in the summer of 69.
Hmm. What about before that, high school, you know, growing up, did you see yourself in the military at all?
No. No. In fact, I never paid any attention. I don't think even in watching much of the news because Vietnam was just everywhere on the news and it was so remote and so far off. And I hadn't known anybody. Really paid any attention to anybody that had ever been there, I think, early on in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it was all around us, but again, in that time, when somebody had been to Vietnam and came back, they'd never talk about it anyway. You wouldn't know who had been there and who hadn't.
Right.
Yeah.
What about within the family? Did you all talk politics? And I wanted to ask you about the news. Did you have an understanding kind of the life outside of Springfield and what was happening in the world? Not necessarily Vietnam, but just in general.
Boy, I don't think so. I don't really remember talking politics at all. I know that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember talking about politics much at all. I just remember the only thing I can remember my stepdad always said was, you know, he was a Democrat and said, by God, the Republicans never been for the working man. I mean, I heard that just over and over and over. But other than that, you know, I didn't pay any attention to any of it. My dad didn't talk much about it either. So.
What do you remember about America and the 1950s? I know you were young, born in 51, but, you know, late 50s, early 60s. What do you remember about the United States?
Well, the 50s is the one big memory I have is when we had the Cuban crisis that happened, because I was pretty young. Uh-huh. I don't remember what year, but I can remember because my parents were still together, and I remember them. My dad bought a bottle capper, and I remember him bottling water. And we had this great big pantry that they had all this bottled water and canned food and all this things in. Because I figured everybody thought, you know, we were going to start shooting missiles back and forth, you know, to Cuba. So that always sticks in my mind. We had this pantry all loaded up with food in case the war started.
Yeah. What about presidents? Do you remember Eisenhower or Kennedy?
I remember Kennedy because, like everybody else, I was in junior high, and might have been seventh grade, but I remember being in band class. I played the trumpet, and there came an announcement over the radio and or the intercom system in the school and saying that everybody was to go home, and I forgot if they announced he'd been shot right then. I think they had, and they pretty much shut the school down, and we all just kind of somberly, everybody walked home. So.
Hmm.
And then we sit the rest of the day, you know, glued in front of the television.
Right. Looking at that time period, that's 62, 63, mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson comes in office in 1963 after the Kennedy assassination. Do you remember any thoughts about, that transition, about Johnson himself? I mean, you're getting old enough where you're in high school, going into college, and... You know, what was your awareness of the presidency and what was happening in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, it was sad to say. I don't think I really cared. Yeah, I think I was at that age. I would have been, 16, 15, 16. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was probably didn't even cross my mind. I was, you know, on to other things with school and cars and, you know, entertaining myself.
Mm-hmm. When did you graduate high school? What year?
1969.
Okay, so yeah, right after that, you're in.
Right.
Did you? Did you not see the war on TV?
Yeah, lots. But it was just. It was almost to me. It was like watching a movie.
Uh-huh.
It was on the news every night, but it didn't really. I wasn't really afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was all over. But it didn't. It didn't seem to have any effect on me.
Did you think about the fact, well, if I don't go to college, then I am going to have to deal with that?
Yeah, and actually, I joined, so I kind of knew that I was in limbo there for a while, but I kind of always thought that by draft or by joining, I was going to end up in the service.
What did your parents think?
They were disappointed. I think my dad was probably the most disappointed, just because of... Given they knew more about what was going on and probably what a mess it was, and when you've got, you know, one of your kids heading off to war is probably nothing anybody wants to deal with either. So, but I kind of made up my own mind. And they dealt with it.
Mm-hmm. Were they upset the fact that you, obviously going into the military, possibly into a war, but that you didn't go to college?
Yeah, my dad was most disappointed. He had put some money away for me to go, but I think I even told him it would be a waste of money. I didn't want to go to school. I didn't have any. I had no ambition at all as far as furthering my education at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and if it would have been if there wouldn't have been the draft, I probably would have figured out some other kind of a job or vocation or whatever it might be. But again, you only had a couple of choices, and that was, you know, college or service at that time.
What do you remember about your friends and your discussions about that subject, about the war and the draft? And
well, a lot of them wouldn't go, and I would think more of them headed off to college just to stay out of the service. Because I remember a few of them that had inquired about getting in the reserves and things, and that was almost impossible because there was just a huge waiting list trying to get in there just to stay out of Vietnam. You know, a few joined, and quite a few got drafted.
What made you join?
I think just to get out of town. I think it was, I didn't have any problems. I just wasn't going anywhere. So,
you got in November 69, is that correct?
Yeah, well, what happened was the friend of mine and I, Kurt Miller, we decided we were going to join, and we thought, well, listen to what my stepdad had said, as far as the Navy and how you had three meals a day and so on and so forth. Well, Eugene is where all the recruiters were, and there were four doors. I think they had the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines were all in a row in this little strip center. So we walked in together to the Navy and sat down and talked to the recruiter. And he said there would be there was a 10-month waiting list just to get in the Navy. And again, that was because there was so many people joining the Navy just so they wouldn't have to actually be in the front lines, I think, in Vietnam. And we decided, nah, there's no way. You know, we were ready to go and made up our minds to go in the service and leave. So the next door happened to be the Army. And we were in there and sat down with his name was Sergeant Stamper. And he had this great big picture of a battle tank sitting behind him and the sergeant stripes on him. And before we knew it, we were signed up on the delayed entry program from then on out. Because it was one of those things where we signed up for all these schools and all of this, and then we had a 90-day delay. Supposedly your rank started from the time we signed. And so I think it was like August, and I think I went in November of, first part of November of that year. That was our 90-day delay. So that was kind of the shocker when we had joined, and I think I finally told my folks, you know, that I'm heading out, and there hadn't been a whole lot of discussion about it.
So the recruiter did his job.
He did a great job. Yeah. Yeah. It was one of those things where we had signed up for, if I had been sitting down with one of my kids, if I would have had the chance, when we got in there, it was just the two of us, and I think I wasn't quite 18 yet. I was almost, but I was 17, and I think my buddy Kurt was 18. And instead of when you join signing up for some kind of school, as in, say, radar technician or whatever it might be that would give you some kind of training, you know, we were just infatuated with being on this big giant tank, so which was had no clue it wasn't going to do us any good down the road. So,
yeah. What did you do in the intervening time before you went in November?
Zero. I think we quit our jobs. I think that 3 months we mainly, they had a strip in Eugene, Lambert Street, we called Drag in the Gut, pretty much every night, just kind of cruised, listened to the radio, and just kind of hung out, didn't really do anything.
Just kind of biding your time waiting.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, tell me about basic training. Where did you go, and what was it like?
Well, basic training means we signed up to go to armor school. Went to which was different because Fort Lewis is real close here. But as we'd signed up to go to tank school, and they would sign up for leadership school and a shake and bake NCO school, we were sent directly to Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I think that was the first time either of us had even been on a jet plane. And one day I do remember when we came up and got our tickets and whatnot we needed to go to Fort Knox, we ended up on standby, but we were put in the first class, and which we thought was kind of neat. And so we sat up front, a couple of kids, and had drinks and flew to Kentucky. And I just remember, that's probably the rude awakening came when, you know, what did we do? You know, once we got off that airplane and got to Fort Knox, the fun was over. It was, you know, you were lonesome, you were afraid, homesick, wish you could take it back, you know, at that time.
Yeah.
But that's where we ended up.
What was your day like at BASIC?
Like everybody else's. You know, I think we got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and, through the drill sergeant screaming and hollering. And luckily, we were both, or I was, and so was Kurt, but I was always fairly physically fit, and athletic enough. And that I had no problem with the physical part of it, which that's mainly what it was. And the mental part, I think I was okay because I was able to deal with a lot of the, the stress that they were putting on everybody. And
how are you able to deal with that?
I think I just actually could I didn't let things get to me really bad. I could, some of the fellas in BASIC, I could just say they were so stressed out. In fact, we had a few people go AWOL, they just couldn't take it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of on the edge in 1969, the end of 69. It wouldn't really, the drill sergeants really wouldn't beat anybody up, and I can remember getting a lot of, fingers and thumps in the chest and smacking the helmet. So there wasn't a lot of physical abuse, but I think it didn't take long until I realized they were doing their job, and I didn't like most of them, but as far as the drill sergeants, but I was able to get through it.
How were you with weapons training and that type of thing, the real military part of that?
That was pretty easy, and I think that came from just my background and my parents. We'd grown up in this kind of town, everybody had done a lot of deer hunting, bird hunting, so I had access to shotguns and deer rifles, and so that wasn't there. A lot of the fellas from the big cities had never even touched, held one of those things. So the military, as far as the basic training and those kind of weapons, so that was pretty easy.
And you said that, once you got there and the thing started, you kind of wish you had taken it back. And did that continue through, or did you?
Oh, yeah, that lasted. That always lasts. That probably lasted until I got out. But it's one of those things when you get in there, and it looks pretty glamorous when you're looking at those posters. And I can see the ads on the TV even today when it looks like, how exciting things are. But, when you get in there and realize that, in fact, I can remember laying there in my bunk at night in BASIC when it was as miserable as you could be in Fort Knox, Kentucky in the wintertime, and thinking that, what are my friends back home doing? They're either in their beds or they're down there, working on their cars or driving up and down Willamette Street or hanging out at the local hamburger joint. There I am with a shaved head, laying in a barracks with a bunch of other bald-headed guys.
Well, when did the mentality start to change that, okay, I'm getting out of BASIC and, I'm going to do okay? Or did that kind of
It never, ever changed a whole lot. Even when I went to leadership school.
Right after BASIC?
I'm trying to remember which it was after AIT.
Well, I'm looking at your questionnaire here, uh-huh. And you did training, and then AIT, it looks like it came after BASIC. And then,
leadership, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, then AIT, actually I went to a couple of AITs. One of them was an armor school, which we were trained on M48 and M60 tanks, which are the big ones that didn't think even used in World War II, I think the M48s. And that was more interesting. It was a little easier to deal with as far as it was laid back. We stayed in some nicer dormitory type of rooms. It was mainly just training. The harassment pretty much had stopped as far as BASIC goes.
Where was this thing?
All in Fort Knox.
Okay.
Everything was in Fort Knox. We had a lot of weekend passes where we could go into town, into Louisville. So it was getting easier, but if somebody would have said, do you want out, I would have been out of there in a heartbeat.
How long did the armor school last?
That one was 8 weeks. And I had I know leadership school I went to was a couple of weeks, and that was mainly more of a spit and polish thing, how to be more of a squad leader, be in charge of people. And I don't think I got much out of that. I mean, it was a lot of spit and polish. That was okay. And I think once that was over, that they sent us to a It was basically a Sheridan tank school, and that was a month, and those are the little tanks that they do have in Vietnam. Well, they had a few tanks in Vietnam, but they had the Sheridans in Vietnam. They're the ones that would actually float, and they shot a little guided missile. So that was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I spent all my training in there in Fort Knox.
Tell me about the tank training, starting with the initial stuff at armor school.
Yeah, that was the tank training was interesting. It was more fun to drive them than anything else. With the crews we had, you know, we had the would be the loader and the gunner and the tank commander and the driver. And, you were trained to do all of those things, and I mean, it was a lot of fun. I guess a lot of fun to shoot them, a lot of fun to drive them. Not much fun working on them, but that's pretty much all we did. They broke down constantly.
Mm-hmm. Were you good at it? I mean, was it real difficult to learn?
No. Surprisingly enough, you look at those tanks, and anybody could do any of the jobs on the things. I mean, they were easy. I guess they have to be. But to drive one, it'd be, you know, it was as simple as driving a car. As far as the cannon on the thing and the machine guns, and we had pretty much the training through AIT and I mean basic and things as far as weapons go, as far as cleaning and maintaining, and it was fun. I was average. I wasn't anything special on them. Just did my job.
Yeah, and these were in 60. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think we had some M48s, M60s, and then the last that was the first school. They were the big ones, the big old the steel ones. But they were, you know, a diesel powered, you know, type of thing. And we learned how to change the tracks and maintenance and the radio system, the communication system. So.
And you were good with cars, right? And the maintenance of cars. So did this help you with tanks?
Some, but we also had mechanics that if something really was wrong with them, the mechanics were there that were trained to work on them. Yeah, we were trained as a crew.
Okay. Tell me about the leadership you had there, starting with basic. What were the drill sergeants like, and then going into armor school? How would you characterize them?
Well, my basic training drill sergeants, there's one I liked and one I couldn't stand me. I can't remember their names. I sure got enough pictures of them. But the main drill sergeant we had, as I remember him, he was a career soldier. Was probably maybe 30 years old, but a decent guy, but, you know, pretty disciplinarian. Had to be. But once in a while, if you could get, you know, him and just a couple of people together, you could actually talk to him. He was about half normal. The assistant drill sergeant we had been in Vietnam and had been a ranger, and just was, he was just terrible. I mean, he was the one that would scream and holler, and if he thought he was doing us a favor, trying to get us ready to go over there, he was wrong, because all we could do was pretty much despise him. So.
What about teaching you the tank? How patient were they? What was that like?
They were patient because the fellows that were teaching in AIT that were doing the tanks, it would be like going to classrooms. You know, we had our drill instructor type people there that ran the, you know, our company, our AIT unit. But you would mainly march off to a classroom or down to the tank motor pool, and you would have certain instructors that would teach you about the cannons or the M50 machine gun or the battle tactics. And so it was mainly it a lot of classroom and a lot of on-hands training is what happened with that.
Mm-hmm. How much did you keep in touch with your family?
Oh, a lot. I mean, you're still homesick. You wrote every day whether you had anything to write about or not, because you wrote as much as you could so people would write you back. So, and then I think I would call like once a week.
What about girlfriends?
Yeah, I kind of had a girlfriend in high school that I would call, you know, and write to. One of those things that didn't go much, you know, past that and, you know, on down the road. In fact, I actually am the one that wrote her a letter saying that when I came back from Vietnam, it pretty much, you know, was over. So I think I saw the writing on the wall as far as a lot of guys that were married or had serious girlfriends when I was even in training. They were miserable, you know, either miserable or worried about what their life's up to or never are not going to see them again for X amount of months or a year or whatever it might be. So I think I was better off not having a real serious relationship.
Okay. Will you describe leadership school? You said it was a lot of spit and polish.
Yeah, I think it was a two-week school. I remember, though, we had to work. You always hear the boot polishing stories and the starching your uniforms. My God, I mean, that was just over the top as far as doing that. And I think that was a lot of classroom also. But I can't remember a lot about it, except we did have one weekend where they took us into Louisville to a USO club of some kind. We kind of had a dance, but what it amounted to was, you know, some of the local girls and some punch and cookies and stuff like that. And it didn't amount to much. It just made you feel even. It made me feel even worse because it's not what we would have been doing if we were home. You know, we would have been at some kind of rock and roll concert at the local armory and sneaking booze in, you know, from outside. Mm-hmm. So it was a little tame for most of the guys, but it was a way to get off the base for a week or for one evening.
Yeah. When you did Sheridan training, tell me the difference between the Sheridan tank and these larger tanks and how much of an adjustment that was for you.
Well, the Sheridan tank was a lot of fun because it was so small. I don't remember how fast it would go, but it was fast. One part of our training, we would drive it right down into a lake, and it would float, mm-hmm. and you could drive it across the water. I believe it had the... We each got to shoot one missile out of it, and what they were was, I call them missile, but as I remember, they had a guide wire on them. But as I recall, when you shot those, because they only got to do it once each, as long as you kept this little red dot in the scope on the target, I mean, they couldn't get away.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of neat. But they also, from what we learned, were very vulnerable as far as landmines and our rocket-propelled grenades and things like that.
Yeah. Did you feel like your training was thorough enough before you went overseas, or was it lacking?
I think it was probably, lacking because, well, for me especially, because I never even saw a tank when I got over there. But I think from some of the fellas, I think that did take the training and were able to even and be on one, I think the adjustment probably had to be made because Vietnam wasn't like there was. I think we were still being trained as we would have been in some kind of open warfare.
Mm-hmm.
I remember on some of the battlefields, we would get in these big online formations with these tanks to go charging across these open fields, like you see in the movie Patton, and we're done World War II. That's not how it was when the guys got there.
Did you go over right after the Sheridan school, or did you?
Yeah, I had an issue where I'd signed up to go to a NCO school or non-commissioned officer school, and we called it Shake and Bake, where you would go in for, I believe it was 4 weeks or 6 weeks, and you'd come out a buck sergeant or an E5
mm-hmm.
sergeant. And I had ran into enough fellas. Well, I was a little bit sick of going to school again, but I'd ran into enough of the fellas that had come back from Vietnam that I realized that I was 18 years old, and there's no way am I going to go over to Vietnam and they're going to put me in charge of some people. I didn't know what to expect once I got there anyway. So it took a little string pulling, but I pretty much refused to go to this next school, and they did finally let me out of it, but I was on my way to Vietnam shortly after that.
When you got your orders, tell me about your reaction and what you did before you went over.
Yeah, when they put the orders up, everybody ran to look. As I remember, there was probably 90% of us, it said Vietnam on it, and I think most of the other guys, the other 10%, maybe were going to Germany, and maybe a couple other ones were heading off to some other schools.
Mm-hmm.
It was no big surprise. I think I looked forward to it because we got a month leave before we were to go over. So, and I still hadn't sunk in what was really going on in Vietnam, but we headed, you know, it was nice to go home for a month, and it wasn't any real big shock.
Well, you seemed like it was pretty casual, that you were expecting this, that, you know, you were going to your fate was sealed almost. This is where you're destined. Is that fair to say?
I guess so. I think it was destined once I had joined the service that I was destined to go to Vietnam. Everybody I pretty much knew, you know, was going. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I was shocked when I got the orders that I was going to go there, and it was just a given that was going to happen. So yeah, it was. I mean, it seems maybe a little easier to talk about now, but it's been a number of years.
Yeah, sure. Well, what about your parents and your stepfather?
Oh, I think they were probably bummed out about it. I know my dad, I don't think, was very happy, you know, even when I joined the service. And I think my mother was worried, of course, like anybody would be. And they never said much, didn't make me feel bad about it. But we never really sit and talked about it. So.
Before you went over, what did you know about the war? What did you know about what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia and its goals, objectives?
Boy, Richard, I tell you, I can't remember a lot about what was probably trying to drill this. The only thing we ever heard was what we were supposed to do to the enemy when we got there. But as far as the politics of that war, and why we were there to fight communism and the takeover of that country, it's probably pretty one-sided, but I never paid a whole lot of attention to it. I didn't really think it made a whole lot of difference to me, you know, what was the politics or what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Did they teach you anything about Vietnamese culture, you know, what the people were like, what the land was like?
No, I don't remember any of that at all. I know when... Not during training. I don't remember any of it. I know we got some kind of handbook when we got over there, but it wasn't really much about being nice to anybody.
Right. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, as far as, you know, the warfare they train you in and the weapons and all it was about was, I remember with the tank training and any of it, I mean, you didn't shoot at targets with bullseyes. They were always silhouettes. Mm-hmm. So every time you were in your tank and you were to fire on a, say, troops, it would be a group of silhouettes that there was a 30 caliber machine gun, I believe, on the ones, and that's what you'd use for personnel, and you'd just mow everything down you could in sight, and then you'd shoot the cannon at whatever kind of vehicle was sitting out there, and pretty much just trained to kill and destroy whatever was out there.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel confident with that mission, you know, kind of your ability to do that, or were you unsure?
I was very unsure. I wouldn't know. You know, I'm a pretty passive kind of guy. I didn't know what would happen.
How about the rest of the people that you were going over with? Did they share those feelings?
I think so. I think the majority of them were, you know, we were all young. I mean, I was probably one of the youngest, but we were all young, and a lot of them had been forced into it. A lot of them had been drafted. Mm-hmm. A few of the fellows that were a little bit older that I knew were having more of the problem, probably because they were more educated, a little bit smarter about worldly ways and what was going on than we were, because a few of them had gone to college for a little while and then dropped out and got their draft notice. They had the toughest time with dealing with what the training was, as far as the browbeating by the instructors and what, you know, what we were, you know, going over to face. So, mm-hmm. But like me, I didn't have a clue. I watched TV a few times and you know what you were told during the training, but you didn't know what it was going to be like when you showed up.
Looking back now, do you wish you had better prepared yourself or knew a little bit more?
Yeah, maybe a little bit more, but I think if you would have known too much, maybe you wouldn't have gone. You know, mm-hmm. I know a lot of guys, I think if you'd realized the war wasn't ever going to go anywhere and how many people were going to be lost all for nothing, I think a lot of people would have said, forget it, we're not going.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, tell me about getting over there and what that was like. How'd you get there?
Yeah, well, we were flying on commercial jets by the time I went. So we got on a jet with had stewardesses on it. And I believe we stopped in Hawaii, and they did let us out of this little airport area. The plane probably had run off. Mm-hmm. So we stopped in Hawaii, I think, to refuel and got the plane for a little while. And I think the next stop, we stopped at Guam, which was interesting. I got a couple pictures of being in Guam, but all it was just a flat, hot beach with a memorial there for the Marines. And there would be a long flight, and once we left Guam, as the stewardesses changed a couple of times. They seemed to get older, and now I realized after that I think they got some kind of hazardous duty pay the closer they got or when they landed in Vietnam, because when they changed planes, they aged a little bit each time. The stewardesses did. And when we got over Vietnam, they announced we were going down. Of course, they came on with all of this, is to take incoming fire and this and that. And we don't know, anything. And all we can visualize is that we're going to land in some kind of a thing like this on the news where the, bombs are going off and rockets and machine guns. And we land and everybody's afraid. And when we get off the plane, you think you're supposed to start running or they'll hand you an M16 or something. And it was just hot, muggy, and stunk. There wasn't anything going on.
What was the mood on the airplane going over? What do you about that?
It wasn't that bad. I remember I sat with a couple other fellas, and they had a cassette recorder with, I think, the new Led Zeppelin tape in the thing. We passed that back and forth, and a lot of guys read. And we were just mainly bored.
Yeah.
It was somber. There was some laughing and joking going on, but it wasn't. It wasn't that bad.
Did you talk about what you all would be facing possibly?
Well, a lot of us did, because it depended on what your MOS was. Mm-hmm. And, mine being a tanker, I think the guys I sat next to, I don't know what they were in, some kind of supply or something. So mm-hmm. We really didn't even know what to expect.
Yeah. This was in June 1970, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your MOS was a tanker.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have your unit of assignment?
No, when we landed in, I believe it was Cameron Bay. Let's see, I always get those backwards. I think it was Cameron Bay. But anyway, when he landed there, you hit the reception station, you wait for your orders. And so we probably were there for 3 or 4 days. And at the time, you would have to make formations, and they would try to line up people to do different kind of duties. Well, I think I hid out most of the time, because I wasn't going to go do KP or any of that. Mm-hmm. They just had these big, massive warehouses where the bunks were, and you'd show up every day to see if you'd got your assignment. And it basically was boring, hot, and there was really nothing going on there. And when I finally did see my name on a set of orders with another group of people, I looked up there and I thought, well, I'm going up to the AmeriCal division in Chu Lai. And the fellow next to me said, and he says, well, there's no tanks there. And I said, well, there's got to be tanks there, because I've been to, two tank schools and all of this. And he says, I don't think there's even no tanks. So I thought, well, that's great, but there's got to be. Cause... Anyway, so long story short, when I did fly up there and got off the helipad there in Chu Lai, the first sergeant was sitting there in a Jeep, and he was kind of a grouchy old guy. And I said, hey, I'm a tanker. And he says, you're not anymore. And I was in the infantry unit.
What did you think about that?
Well, I was pissed. I couldn't believe it. And I even told him, I said, I have no idea, infantry unit. He says, well, everybody's basic MOS is. And I said, I understand that, but, it's not me. I'm a tanker. I mean, I joined the Army to be a tanker. So his name was Top Miller, and he ended up being an okay guy. I never liked him much when I was there, but I think he was a decent guy. And I remember we got there. I think there were three of us who picked up and headed us back to the rear area, because the company was out in the field. And pretty much got the supply clerk out there, and they gave us each a rucksack, an M16, how much ammunition, I forgot how much they gave us, and a couple of smoke grenades, a couple of frags, enough sea rations for, I think, 5 days, canteens, poncho liner, and that was it. And I'm looking around thinking, I can't believe it. I just can't believe what's happened here. So that was my introduction to that company I was with.
Huh. Tell me what your impressions were of Vietnam, the country, when you got off in Cameron Bay and as you make your way up to July.
Yeah, Cameron Bay was just flat, hot, smelled, things going on, trucks. I mean, because the war had been going on quite a while, so it was built up. I really didn't see anything. We flew in probably, I think it was a C-130 that came up to Chu Lai and landed. And again, you can see the hillsides, because we were way up north. We were not far from Da Nang. And it was very mountainous, except we were stationed on the beach, which was just beautiful. So the landscape, it was a pretty place. But at the time I was, when I first got there, I wasn't too much, I wasn't worried about pretty or whatnot, because it was, here I was going to be in an infantry unit, and I just thought, man, I'm never going to make it through this. So,
you're there, you've been assigned your stuff, and you're wondering, you know, why am I in the infantry?
Right.
Could you get a good answer besides, well, that's everybody's basic MOS?
Nah, I really couldn't get much of an answer, but what I think that what had happened, and we realized right after that, was that the AmeriCal division had lost so many people and were taking heavy casualties that they just couldn't supply them with enough of the MOS, which was the 11 Bravo, which is an infantryman. So they were taking tankers, which we were what you called an 11 Echo MOS, and then 11 Deltas were, I think, recon and the different ones. Anybody that had the 11 or a combat MOS, they were taking and putting them in infantry units. But as far as the first sergeant, he really didn't have much to say. He was kind of short about it. We were all, as I remember, there were, I think, three of us came in together. One was a good friend of mine that I'd met when I got in country, named Jesse Hill. And I believe we were all tankers that showed up that day. So not knowing really what to do and never had a rucksack on before.
Really?
It was unbelievable.
Wow.
And M16 training, we had been trained with M14s most of the time, which were the, you know, the longer wood stock rifles.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think they probably used them in Korea. But that's what we were trained on in basic, and we'd seen M16s a couple of times in AIT because we were on tanks, and then we had an M16 in our hand. We didn't really know much about and hand grenades, and didn't know much about what we had.
Wow. That seems like a tremendous disadvantage for you all.
Well, it was. I think they needed bodies. It was just kind of a bum deal. It was a waste of money, too, all the money that they'd spent on it. And then, you know, we were basic grunts.
Well, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Tell me, well, before we get into what your uniform is, and I want to get a description kind of what you carried, were there others who were pulled from the tank MOS and placed in the infantry unit?
Yes.
Or was it everybody?
No, there was a lot of them. There were a lot of tankers, and a lot of the people had been trained, I think they called it, on recon, which is more of a mechanized infantry, and some of the grunts. But there were, come to find out, there were a lot of us that had been pulled that had tank MOSs that were in this unit.
Why did they pull you and the others?
They needed bodies.
So it was random.
It was a random thing, and there weren't enough, I don't think, what you called 11 Bravo MOSs that were coming in country.
Mm-hmm.
So they were taking whoever they could. I don't remember what the real company strength ought to be in platoons, but I know we were always short. We just never had enough people, even once I got in there.
I think a full platoon is, you know, 150.
Yeah, and
fully loaded one.
Yeah, I don't think we were ever close to that. So that's why I think they were taking anybody they could get. And again, this was in 1970, you know, getting towards the end of things.
Sure. Had anybody at this point told you, you know, here's where we are in the war?
No. No, not at all. We didn't have any idea what to do. In fact, as far as the jungle warfare goes, we had, as I recall, we did have, when we got into country, it's kind of the reception station. It's real kind of unclear where we were, but I remember going through about a two-day, might have been a one-day kind of crash course. They had us crawling through make-believe minefields and booby traps and things like that. But it didn't last very long. I would remember more about it.
Did you think that, or were you aware that that was the kind of war you'd be dealing with and not a conventional type war?
I'd never really given it a whole lot of thought because I always pictured myself riding around on a tank.
Right.
Yeah, you know, up and down the roads or whatever there might be. I didn't have any idea that I'd be on the ground like that.
had you heard of My Lai at this point?
Yeah, I'd heard of My Lai, in which we were close. We were in the same, of course, AmeriCal was, Lieutenant Kelly was there, and he was just, I don't think that where that happened was probably, I don't think it was 20 miles from where we were, and probably even closer than that. But I'd heard about it on the news, but that had been a couple of years prior.
Right. I didn't know if there was any mention of that at training or once you got there.
No, then really it was pretty – nobody talked a whole lot about anything as far as training and as far as what to expect. I think the little crash course on being out in the jungle was just about worthless. So, yeah, it pretty much when we get to that point, we pretty much just got dumped out in there.
Looking back, is that shocking?
It was shocking at the time and still amazes me, to this day.
Huh. Okay. What was your uniform like? What did you carry with you in the field?
Well, when we first got there, what we were handed to us is we had the jungle boots we've been given, fatigue pants, fatigue shirt with a T-shirt, and a steel pot with the liner that went inside of that, other than your helmet, besides the other gear. But shortly after that, when we got in the field, we realized, what we really ought to be wearing and adjusted accordingly once we got out there.
And what was that?
Well, at that time, and a lot of units didn't let their people, and I've looked at so many pictures since and seen what other people have worn, but our unit was kind of a loose, I don't know if you call it a loose cannon or not, but it was, we pretty much, once I was in there, we did what we wanted, dressed like we wanted. The steel pots, all they were they might have been a safety type of thing and for your protection, but to us they were nothing but another, so much weight because we were carrying so much on our backs anyway. And by the time I got done, I bought some leopard type fatigue pants and I wore a T-shirt, and about half the time I had an Australian bush hat I wore, and that was it. I had no helmet. Everybody dressed kind of how they wanted to, which was, I think, strange now, but we were caught up in that. We didn't want to get our hair cut. We wanted to dress like we wanted to dress because, we were coming out of the latter 60s from being at home.
Mm-hmm.
I know the people prior to us had on, a lot of them had to wear flak jackets. Most of the units, they had to wear steel pots. Our CO didn't make us.
Was that more of a discipline problem thing, or did he just understand that, this is the way it is?
Well,
okay.
I think he understood, because when I first came in country, the lieutenant we had, I don't think he even really wanted to be there, because we didn't have enough officers, and he should have been out of the field by then.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a real decent guy and kind of made to stay. But I think he understood that you had to kind of give a little bit, because we were all kind of in the same situation, and if, letting our dress code go a little bit astray, kept us a little bit happier or more congenial to each other, it was a better way to be.
Right. What else did you have with you?
As far as carrying?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
let me ask you this way. What were you assigned? What was the standard issue equipment what filled your rucksack, et cetera. And then what did you guys actually, how did you modify it once you
arrived? Well, what we were handed was, we were handed some old plastic canteens, not the collapsible ones when the first sergeant gave us our things. And the old rucksacks, I think, were from the Korean War, the first ones we got. But we were given rucksacks, so many days of sea rations, the M16, and I think a couple, what you call bandoleros, or I think you call them that.
Bandoliers
of ammunition, two frags or hand grenades, a couple of smoke flares. I think we got some iodine tablets for the water, a bottle of mosquito repellent, and a poncho on a poncho liner. That was the initial thing that was handed to us before they started heading us out to the field. But that was day one in the company when there was three of us, and we were just in the rear waiting to go out to hook up with the rest of the people.
Okay. How many of there were you that were going to go out and be
there? There was three. There was a friend of mine from Tennessee that I'd met coming in, and the third fellow, I don't remember his name, but there were three of us. We were all just brand new.
You were assigned to Charlie Company, 5th Battalion, 46th Infantry, 198th Light Infantry Brigade,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And were you told that at this point, this is who you're going to be?
We were told that, once we got up to the AmeriCal, because when we got our orders to come up to the AmeriCal division in July after we'd gotten into country, I think once we got in there and spent that day or so processing into the division is when we got our other set of orders saying we were to go with this Charlie Company.
Okay. So tell me about going out to the field.
That was the good one. We were hauled out by the first sergeant again, and one of the Hueys was at the helipad, which was close to the rear area,
mm-hmm.
and. I think it was a little bit of resupply on the helicopter, a mail bag. The three of us scrambled on. I had never been on a helicopter like that before and sat there on the floor. And the top Miller just kind of gave us a wave. The helicopter took off, and there were a couple little villages right outside of the gates of the Chulai base. And, you know, the pilots, they probably were 25 years old, maybe, that were flying this thing. We knew we were brand new, and the door gunners did. So, I mean, they did their best to scare the heck out of us. They they buzzed the tree lines and stayed as low as they could and got a real kick out of that. We were just hanging on. We didn't know you couldn't fall out of the thing, you know, as far as when they would bank real sharp and that. And they gave us quite a ride, but I think it was... We were afraid. I mean, all of a sudden here, there was three of us, and these helicopters didn't know anybody. We didn't know where or what we were, you know, in for. And so all of a sudden, we're flying up, you know, over these mountains, which was what's surrounded by Chulai.
Mm-hmm.
We came down into a valley, real fast and real low, and we could see a smoke grenade going off down there. And they got real low, and they started hollering, "Get off, get off!" And a couple of guys came running out from the brush, and to meet us. And we scrambled off there and scrambled back up into the brush and kind of looked around. And I thought, I can't believe it. You know, here we are. The helicopter was gone. And, you know, it's hot, humid. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I got, you know, 340 or 50 days left of this or whatever it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we processed in, it was scary because I looked around and the fellas were dressed how they wanted to be dressed. Nobody had helmets on, and it was they were in a really bad spot as far as just the vegetation that were going on. And I knew they split us up, and I went to, I believe it was First Squad, and the squad leader's fellow's name was James, which I've been in contact with the last couple of years. But first thing he asked me how old I was and if my mother knew where I was, because I always looked young.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that was,
and I said, man, I she knows where I'm at, but I wish I was back there now. You know, it was bad.
That was a joke he was saying.
Yeah. He couldn't believe, he was shaking his head that here this baby faced, you know, 18-year-old is what they sent him. And we all three, I think, looked about the same that mm-hmm. just got out there. So that was, and that's where we spent the first night.
What was the vegetation like?
That was real thick. That was jungle. That hour or so after that, I was scratching my leg and realized and looked down there, I had a couple of leeches on me, which I'd never seen a leech before. So one of the guys in the squad came over with his bug juice and shot some on it, and they showed me how to, you know, better tuck my pants into my boots and strap them down and kind of ways to try to keep the leeches off, but it was pretty impossible. And not much sleep that night. We were on an area where they had set up some claymore mines and for protection, and we just kind of sat tight for that evening until we moved out the next day. But it was a little unnerving experience for the first night when you're 18.
Yeah. What was it like that night? You're in the jungle for the first time.
Yeah.
In a war.
Yeah. And, well, luckily, there was no shooting or anything going on that night, but it was so hot and so humid and so wet. Plus, I'd already had the leeches on me already.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't see anything, and yet we were told we have to watch down the trail for if anybody comes up the trail, you know, as far as, you know, BC or NVA that are wandering around at night. And I mean, I couldn't figure out how you're going to see them anyway. And I'd never, ever set up a Claymore mine, and I went out with one of them, and one of the fellows was trying to show me how you set up the Claymore mines. And it was just, I just could not believe anybody could survive, you know, any length of time at all under those conditions.
How did the guys take you in? Did they accept you or not?
Always there's a couple of them that do. And I saw that as time went on, and I became one of the old timers in there. We had one of the fellas, we called him, his name was Wimpy. I think his name was Winfred or whatever it might be, but Wimpy Boudreaux, he'd been there a while, but he was always one of the nicest guys to the new guys. And he kind of took me under his wing. I know our squad leader, James, which we kind of got to be closer together after I was there a little while. He was very distant, very kind of a hardcore type person that he was not a touchy-feely type of guy at all. So, and we had a few other ones in his squad. We had a fellow named Davenport, a big ex-football player, college player that was there that was real decent, you know, to me. So overall, most of them were there to give you a hand, you know, try to help you through it.
Did anyone give you a hard time immediately?
Not immediately. I never saw anybody do that. And even with all the racial problems that were in the rear at that time, and they were really bad as far as blacks and whites go. But once everybody was in the field, color wasn't ever an issue.
What was the racial makeup of the company?
Oh, I'm trying to think. I believe that it was probably, I want to say 20% black, I would guess, versus white. Mm-hmm. We had a couple of people from Puerto Rico, I think, that were with us. But it was probably 20% as far as Afro-American.
Tell me about the racial issues back in the rear. I wanted to ask you about that anyway.
Yeah, that was really bad. I had growing up in Springfield, Oregon, I'd only known one black family in my life, and they were really just a different color. There was no their culture. Ours were all the same, and they were just fine. We went to school together, played together, did everything together. And when I got into training back in Fort Knox, we had a lot of Detroit people, Indianapolis, a lot of from East Coast black guys I met, and I never had a problem with them, and I was always friends with them, but there was always a problem, even in training, with the white guys from the South and the blacks, and I never understood it, because it didn't bother me, but there was a problem there. And when we got into country, the same type of racial tension was going on. It never affected me, and I think it must have showed even in my mannerisms, because I never ever had a problem with any of the black guys. When a lot of blacks and whites did, I was friends with, you know, everybody, and I had as many black friends as I did white friends. And the one fellow that I came in country with, which was on the helicopter, which I still see and in contact with, a real good friend, is Jesse Hill, and he's a black friend of mine from Tennessee. But you know, as we go on in this, there was some real issues as time went on when I was there between the field and the rear areas as far as blacks and whites go.
What about your viewpoint? You said you really hadn't been exposed to that while you were there. Did anything shift within you?
No, not at all. I got a little disgusted at some of them because it started, and this is later on in my time there, but it ended up being a white man's war, they claimed. And this is after the fact. This is months after I'd gotten there. But it was a white man's war, and a lot of them would refuse to go out. And when they would refuse to go out, a few of the white guys would say, well, if they aren't going out, we're not going to go out, as far as back into the field. So there was a lot of tension there between some of them. Again, not me. There was a lot of fist fights and a lot of threats and things like that, and as far as in the rear goes. But I don't think it ever affected me, and I still had my same amount of the black friends that I always did. So.
Yeah. Okay. And you said that once you're in the field, that stuff didn't exist.
Pretty much it was not even an issue. I had always had you know, I think everybody pretty much left that alone. I don't remember really any problems in the field between blacks and whites. There always was when we got back into the rear for a couple of days, but I don't remember anything in the field there ever being a problem with the blacks and whites.
Okay. Well, you described kind of the first few hours out there in that first night.
Mm-hmm.
How did you see the morale of the guys?
And it didn't look good to me. I mean, everybody, you know, bitched and moaned and groaned, and I can't remember a lot of what was said because I was still just afraid. But I think I did inquire what we did, and basically all we did was they said we would pretty much patrol certain areas and search and destroy and try to cut off these VC supply routes and set up ambushes at night, and they kind of said that's what we were up to. And, you know, with any luck, we'd get to go back to the rear in a number of days and spend a day or two back there before we came back out. So that's, I guess, what I learned right away.
So this is what they said. Here's what we do.
Yeah, here's kind of what we do, and it didn't make a whole lot of sense, but I think that's how they lined it out. And basically, you know, and the next morning you just get up and start following the guy in front of you. So.
Did you feel prepared, or were you?
No, I wasn't prepared at all.
I mean, were you even more nervous once you?
I think I was more nervous then. I was exhausted. I couldn't believe I forgot what the weight was. It could have been 40 or 50 pounds, whatever we had on our backs. And then we all shared carrying M60 machine gun ammunition. And it was just the weight and the heat and the terrain. It was just unbearable. You could even walk through that type of thing, carrying all that on your back, you know, let alone, you know, ask you to do any fighting at all.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What about the M16? I mean, were you trying to familiarize yourself with that?
I think. I knew enough about it, but I was one of those. I wasn't adamant about trying to keep it clean like other people did. I think I did my best to keep it clean and keep my gear kind of in order, but I think I wasn't overly concerned about the thing, but I was familiar enough to keep it in working order.
Did they help you with that? You know, like, here's how you need to treat it. Here's
we'd had some of that training, a little bit of that training, I think, in one of the schools I'd gone to, but like I say, mostly it was M14, which we never saw. So we had some of that, and then I think that I ended up carrying the M60 for a little while too, but that was once I'd been there a little bit. But M16, it was fine.
Okay. The first day out, what did you do?
Well, the next morning when we got up to move is the first time that I had come under fire, which is everybody has to do it once.
And right, the very first day you did.
Yeah, well, the next morning.
I mean,
I went in there late in the afternoon. And we were walking up through on a side of a kind of an open hillside in that single file fashion, and they were trying to explain to us new guys about keep our intervals, and every time you'd see a twig or a stick or something out of place, they'd stop and you'd point and you'd step over it, and then you'd turn around and do the same to the guy behind you, and it was just this slow, methodical movement. And we I don't know what time of the morning it could have been, but we were in this exposed area, and we heard they were across a little valley. I don't know how far they would have been away from us, maybe 75 yards, and some small arms fire opened up on us, and not knowing what to do, and with another new guy I was right next to, once they started shooting, all the guys that had been there, they took off up the hill and jumped behind bushes, trees, rocks, whatever they could find, and I remember the other fellow and myself just sat on the ground and just started spraying the other hillside. You couldn't see who was shooting at you half time anyway. And we just sat there and just started spraying the hillside, thinking that's what we're supposed to do, until I realized that the rest of them were screaming at us to get out of there and come up the hill and get behind whatever they were behind. So luckily nobody got hit that day, but that was the first day. And then we stayed there, and they called in a gunship, and the gunship came in and probably spent $10,000 in ammunition blowing up this hillside that there was nobody on anymore, and then we just walked off.
How did it feel?
Actually, it felt pretty good. That felt good because I knew I could do it. I think up until that time I wasn't sure what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And rarely do you ever see anybody anyhow when those firefights start. It was just always mass confusion, and I realized all it was just a bunch of chaotic screaming, hollering, shooting, and in whatever direction it was, and nobody ever aimed in their life that I was around. So, but it felt decent that I knew I could respond when we had when something like that happened.
Mm-hmm. Was it loud?
Yeah, very loud, but very chaotic. I don't think I paid much attention to anything until I could realize somebody was hollering at us to get undercover. And that's lucky, though, those guys on the other side were not any better shots than we were. So.
Yeah. Had they briefed you on here's who the enemy is, and here's what the makeup is, here's what they do?
No, I don't think I'd ever done any of that until I got there, and slowly I figured out, you know, that we were up against the Viet Cong, and also NVA regulars were in our area, too.
Well, I was wondering if the guys in the unit said, "Look, Dave, here's what we're up against."
Yeah, they did. They did. I don't remember paying a lot of attention to what they were saying, but I do remember that we would be into it. We were going to run into both of them, and most of the time, I think it was more like the VC we would stumble upon, or there was a lot of snipers going on, and them against us, mm-hmm. and they would kind of hit and run all the time. And I think that was more the VC that we'd run into.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the mission basically sounds like it was search and destroy.
Pretty much all the time.
Okay. So after this first encounter, you guys walked off the hill and you just continued doing the same thing?
Same thing, yeah. We would set up, I don't remember that night. I'm sure we did ambushes almost nightly, where we would set up a perimeter for usually the platoon and the company would all be close. We only had two platoons there for a while because it was so few of us. And we would send ambushes out that night with the radios. And then I kind of learned, you know, what that was all about. And I don't remember if that was it, but most of the time, with our squad leader and the other ones, we were there just to survive and to get out of there. We didn't really want to find anybody. So we would go to the most safe and secure place we thought we could be and set up the claymores and just kind of huddle together and keep quiet all night long and wait for daylight to be able to get back out of the thing.
Mm-hmm. Was that the attitude of most of the men?
Pretty much everybody. We had I remember a couple of the times that we would early on be in some of the fire support bases and they would send us out in that same area to do ambushes. We were to be in one location, yet we would just walk down behind the hill where they couldn't see us anymore and set up in places that weren't even, which was kind of stupid at the time. But, you know, they expected us to walk out in these real high traffic areas where they thought we were going to be able to ambush somebody, and we would just get out there far enough where we could get out of sight and set our own stuff up and lay low. And I don't know if we ever got caught or not. May have, but I don't think it mattered. At that point, even if we did get caught doing something like that, nobody cared.
What do you mean, get caught?
Well, get caught by the company commander, you know, or the platoon leaders. Mm-hmm. Because if they were said, you go to these coordinates on the map, mm-hmm. and they think we're there, we weren't really there part of the time. We were in another area completely. We weren't even at that spot because they were trying to put us in, some of the time, some of the hot spots that were probably dictated from battalion even higher up where they wanted the ambushes to be placed.
Mm-hmm.
And all that we could think of, you know, usually there was, I think there were usually five of us in an ambush that, you know, forget it. You know, that looks a little bit dangerous, so we're not going there. We'll just go down around the corner here and set our stuff up as best as we can to protect ourselves and then get through the night and come back.
How often did you all do that?
Oh, I bet you we did that. Oh, boy, percentage-wise, I don't really know because I was never in charge of. I always let squad leader James take care of that. We probably did that 20% of the time, not all the time, because not all the time would have been in real hot spots. But the whole issue there was just trying to get home. We weren't trying to win anything.
Right. Was that pretty common throughout the whole tour?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Most of the time with the guys I was with, and even the one real decent lieutenant that, you know, in fact, he'll be at the reunion too. Name's Bob Amos. I carried the radio for him later on as an RTO. He did his job, but he wouldn't take any unnecessary chances, you know, with it. It just wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
So we all knew that we weren't going to win this thing, and we just needed to get everybody home.
So that was the attitude that, you know, this thing is pretty much over. We're not gonna.
Yeah.
We're not gonna win.
It was with most all of us. Once in a while, you get a gung-ho person show up, and you know, a couple of times we got a couple of lifer types that were there for their second tour that were really into, you know, the ambushes or, you know, trying to seek out, you know, the enemy and engage him. And most of the time, if we knew the enemy was in one certain area, we'd be going the other way. And there was no way we wanted to make any contact with them. And I think they probably felt the same way.
Can you describe the enemy?
The ones I saw, the first one I saw was a North Vietnamese. As far as we early on, again, probably only a day or two after I first fire that we were under, was we'd stopped in the middle of the day. We kind of were in a long line and in a kind of a horseshoe shape, and we're taking a break. And a fellow named Davenport, which is a big football player, he was next to me, and I saw him look kind of shocked, and he raised up and aimed his M16 and shot one shot. And I thought, well, what was he doing? Well, I looked over, and I saw a person kind of stumble and fall. And he went running over there and told me to stay where I was. And what had happened was, is when we'd walked in the semicircle and sat down quiet, this NVA officer had stood up and looked around trying to figure out where we were. Well, we all sat down. And Davenport had seen him, and I couldn't believe he could aim and shoot, but he took one shot and shot and killed this fella, and I'd never seen a dead person, you know, until then. And I remember, and I didn't want to go over there. And he finally said, come on, you got to go. And we went over. He took me over there. The fella was dead, and I don't remember where he'd shot him at, really, but he'd had a pith helmet on, and Davenport handed me the pith helmet, and inside there, I'll never forget it, was a picture of a young woman, young Vietnamese woman, and on one side of it, and it was I believe it was a drawn picture, and on the other side was a drawn in ink picture of a duck. And I don't know what the symbolism of that, but he had a picture, probably his wife or girlfriend on one side, and a duck on the other side. But that probably hit home as hard as anything, realizing that, you know, finally, hey, this guy's not going home, and that's his wife or girlfriend, and, you know, I don't know what the duck's all about. And so James, which was our hardcore squad leader, and I haven't ever brought this up to him, but it's no big secret, but he always was pretty hostile against him. Well, this fellow was dead. And we had lost people before I got there, I guess, plenty of toe poppers and landmines and things. And as I remember, James, we're standing there looking at this dead fella, and James put this M16 up against his nose, and I thought I was just going to poke him. The guy was dead, and pulled the trigger and pretty much blew his face off.
And you saw this?
Yeah, and that was just, and all of a sudden I'd seen, you know, in a couple of 3 days more than I could have believed in a lifetime. And then that was kind of the ugly side of war. You got Davenport on one side that shoots one time and trying to get me, you know, I guess, adjusted to what's coming up. Mm-hmm. And then James, which is got such hatred, you know, for him, that just blows the guy's face off, and we're all standing around there. And that was, yeah, one of those things you don't forget.
How did you feel at this point about what was happening to you?
I don't know if I was numb or not. I guess it was, after a while, you quit being afraid. You're always afraid of certain things, but that would be a hard one. I think I was almost to the point where I thought, there's no way I'm going to live through this. It isn't going to happen. And we hadn't started hitting booby traps yet, but I had just seen the way that we had to live. I heard about how many people had been either the feet blown off or killed in mines. It's usually mines or booby traps is what hit us all around there. And how many new guys were there, including me, and thought, there's just no way someone can survive out here like this for 12 months. that was, I just was amazed, because some of the guys that just only had a couple of months left, there wasn't very many of them, I just can't believe they made it through it. And yeah, I'm sure physically they might have, but mentally a lot of them didn't.
Yeah. What else about the enemy? What would you consider the enemy's strengths?
Most of them were so mobile. You know, the ones that we ran into were mostly hit and run. We would get sniped at and they would disappear. Their strengths were their booby traps. We had an incident where we were operating in another AO. This thing was one of those sketchy deals, but we had been, as I remember, we had been sniped at off and on either morning. I think it's afternoon. And heading up the hill, and it was our whole platoon, and I think actually both platoons, because we were so small, and we'd been sniped at a few times going up to get to the top of this one hill to set up a night defensive perimeter, I think is what we were after. Mm-hmm. And not knowing much about, I knew they could set booby traps, and we'd been told about toe poppers and different things, but this is one of those things that we got up just about to the top of this hill, and we had, they were bringing in a resupply helicopter to drop off, I remember, some chocolate milk. And one of the interpreters that we had with us, which is like a Vietnamese scout, I thought he saw something. He walked over, and he'd hit a tripwire, which was on one of their fashioned. It was a daisy-chained booby trap from, I think, artillery round canisters. And I believe there was three of them. Later on, I got a letter from a chaplain that had kind of done some research what happened. But long story short, they were very talented, because this thing killed six of us and wounded 27, you know, all in one mine. And I was one of the fortunate few that it knocked me down, and I didn't get a scratch. But it was, again, we'd lost so many people, and just one of those things that I think they knew they might have been running us up this hill this whole time when we got sniped at. But they had the ability, I think, with patience to know that we were dumb enough to go up to the highest point all the time to set up, so they'd had this waiting for us.
How far into your tour was this?
That happened, I got there in June, that happened in July.
Okay.
So I was a little into a month, I think a little over a month, and when they got done with that, and there's a whole story involved in this, that whole thing, what happened afterwards, but by the time they cleared everybody out of there, I was almost one of the old-timers.
Really?
There were so many of them gone. Hmm. Yeah, and that's because you figure we lost like 33 people, you know, to that one incident.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost some of the higher up, you know, the sergeants and the E6s that we had, and the platoon leaders. It was a devastating thing to our company. In fact, there was I think I looked up I ordered something from the Washington archives. I forgot where I got that from, but kind of talked about it. But that was a pretty major loss for one booby trap.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that a little bit more
sure.
in detail when we get to that
yeah.
point. What about weaknesses of your enemy?
Well, they didn't have much firepower, which was a good point to us. As I recall, too, a couple of times we would run into a couple of VC. We came around the corner one time with a couple of them. Usually they'd have like one weapon to two or three of them. So they didn't really have much. So the weaknesses would be probably the firepower and no backup firepower. I mean, we had artillery and helicopters, and we had all kinds of jets and whatever we needed. They didn't have much. I think up north they might have had some artillery that, you know, they could use once in a while, but down our way they had what they could carry, and that was all.
Okay. Were you all going up mainly against the Viet Cong, or was it a mix?
It was a mix. I remember mostly Viet Cong. Once in a while we'd run into some NVA, but, you know, kind of quirky things like that Davenport visual story when he did shoot that one that, mm-hmm. that just screwed up and stumbled onto us probably.
Mm-hmm.
But never ran into any massive, luckily I was never involved in one of those big major battles against the NVA. It was always just small skirmishes all the time.
What were the major tactics that were used, I guess, by the VC?
Against us?
Against you all, yes.
Yeah, well, their major tactic was just setting landmines always in front of us. So, I mean, every time we would get ready to go somewhere, I think they probably knew we were going, but we would run into toe poppers or those trip wires, or saw a few punji pits, but they were so obvious that nobody had ever fallen into one of them. But it was mainly landmines and booby traps, and they would snipe at us, but honestly, the whole time I was there, all the sniper fire we came under, I can remember a few bullets, but I heard them buzzing like bees over me, but I never saw anybody get shot from them. I think they were, I think they'd shoot so fast and be on a dead run because they knew that once they shot once, we'd, you know, everybody in the world would unload on the direction they were in, so they were out of there fairly fast.
Right, right. Do you want to talk about those booby traps, the different kinds, and
sure.
How you avoided them, how you spotted them?
Yeah, and that's something that's learned as you were there. I mentioned earlier that walking down the trails, every time something looked a little out of place, like maybe a leaf that didn't look right, or a stick that didn't look right, or an old can, you would step over it. The person walking point to us would always be trying to find those, and then as each person progressed up the trail, he would stop, step over it, turn around, stop, point at it, and the next person would do the same, mm-hmm. until we all got over it. But those are mainly toe poppers. And that would be an old sea ration can full of explosives that basically just blow your foot off or both of them off. And that's mainly what our area, what we ran into once in a while, like I said, like the big ones, the big booby traps. But it was mainly toe poppers that they'd set for us.
And these were in like a can?
They were set in like sea ration cans and filled with explosives and glass and whatever metal scraps or anything they could put on them. It had some kind of a pressure sensitive device that I think they might have used too, the handles off our frags or hand grenades as far as the pressure, and you would step on them and they would go off and that would be your foot.
And what was the closest one that went off to you?
In front of me and behind me, I had a fella that had stepped on one and blew one of his feet off, and it basically threw dirt and things in my eyes. I couldn't see for a couple of seconds, and then I thought I'd stepped on it, and when I finally could see right, I'd looked, and it was one of the fellows laying there in front of me, and the medic had already ran up there, and I kind of helped hold the fella down, and the medic was shooting some morphine into him, but it had blown his foot off, and he was going into shock. But it was just your typical toe popper, and that was one of the instances when we, you know, I'm sure he made it. I wish I could remember his name. I can't. But Doc Boggs was the medic, and so I kind of held him down, and we got him fairly calm, and he kept wanting to look, and I think he finally got a look, and so I'd lost his foot, and then that's really when I think shock started in. But the medevac helicopter, our problem with that one was when the medevac got close and was coming in, there had been some, I think there must have been BC, not far from us, and they had opened up on this helicopter, and the helicopter wouldn't land, and that was kind of tough. So the helicopter took off again and was just kind of hovering way up, and we had to send guys out to try to run the VC off just to get this guy hauled out of there. But I had a couple of those, but that was probably the closest one as far as the toe poppers that I know of that somebody hit right next to me.
How do you deal with that? Someone right next to you, someone you know, someone you've been out there risking your life with, who loses a foot right in front of you.
Yeah, that happened, and that was common. Even one of our staff sergeants that had come over there, his last name was Buckley, kind of went running up to an area that I didn't think he should have been up front in, but he was kind of in charge, and he lost one of his, and the strange thing after that happens, or like the big mine that we'll talk about, is that when all of the chaos and all everything's over and you're sitting there that night, you realize you're never going to see them again. It's just they were here, they're gone, you know, their life's changed. It's a strange feeling when that happens, and it's happened so close to you, and it could be you. You just, it could be just a matter of time till it happens to you, but you can kind of come complacent as far as, not that you're not afraid and you're not cautious, but, you know, if you worried too much about it, you wouldn't take a step in any direction.
Sure. Did that prevent you from getting close to people? Did you deliberately try not to get close to people?
No. No, I always, everybody has their certain friends. No, we all rely on each other.
Well, Dave, why don't we take a break?
Okay.
This is Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview for the Vietnam Archives Oral History Project with Mr. Dave Hammond. Today is May 11th, 2006, and it's almost 10:15 a.m. Central Standard Time, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Dave is in Beaverton, Oregon. Dave, let's pick up where we left off, and that was really your first patrol and getting out into as an infantryman and experiencing that. And being an infantryman by surprise, not what you had signed up to do over there. I want to ask you, before we get into specifics and before we get into specific patrols and incidents that you remember, could you describe what a typical day was like for you, you know, initially, and if that continued? If it didn't, what changed?
Very early on in the first few days in the field, I was pretty much totally exhausted, and the reason is because of the weight of what we carried. And I know we talked about that earlier, but from the not being accustomed to the humidity and to the weight and the terrain, even being a fairly physically fit 18-year-old, you would almost collapse many times during the day. So most of our day would consist of patrols. We would be moving from one point to another point. I think they would call them search and clear, search and destroy missions. And once we would get to these areas, we would seems like we'd walk most all day, and then we would set up at night on some kind of a night defensive perimeter, either on the top of a hill or wherever it might be, and get ready for the evening, and then we would send ambush groups out of either 4 or 5 people and be awake the majority of the night, and then in the morning come back in at daylight, and everybody would hook up and we would start trudging off down the trail again to a new spot. So it was a pretty monotonous type of a day. That's just pretty much what it was. It wasn't any fun.
What about meals, breakfast, lunch, dinner?
Yeah, and everybody, we pretty much ate when we wanted to. What we had, sea rations that we had were the typical olive drab green cans and the real dry crackers. And there were spaghetti and meatballs and pork slices and beans and weenies. And we even had breakfast sea rations, which were pretty bad, and some of those were scrambled egg and ham. I remember being in a can. Along with those in those sea rations would be either a little pouch of hot chocolate, coffee pouch, salt and pepper, probably, you know, I think there was a little thing of toilet paper and maybe gum. The highlight was once in a while they would bring out a resupply helicopter, and they would bring us what we would call, we called them LERPs. I don't know what their name was, but it was the freeze-dried food where you would heat a canteen up full of water, pour it in, and it would be chicken and rice or another form of spaghetti. So it's a little better meal than that. And once in a while, we would on resupply, they would drop and we called these a SP pack. And again, I'm not sure what the SP was for, but it was a giant plastic bag full of candy that didn't melt, chocolate that didn't melt, so that's kind of scary, and gum and shoelaces and toothpaste and toothbrushes and writing tablets and pens and things, and that was a highlight during the day. So as far as food went, you know, it wasn't any good, but we always seemed to have enough, and I don't ever really remember running out of food. It was, once in a while, water got kind of scarce, but we seemed to always have enough. Well, and our appetites were probably not that big anyway.
What did you like the best? What was your favorite meal?
Yeah, I think mine would have been the I think it was beans and weenies came in one of those. Those were not bad. And then everybody's favorite was the pound cake and the pears for dessert. So those are probably the favorite ones I had. And then we had a way we would use these journal tabs. and make a little stove to heat the things up. So it helped a little bit. We could also cook, you know, the hot chocolate up on them too. But I think that was beans and weenies, probably my favorite.
Which ones did you hate?
God, well, the lima beans were really bad. Nobody wanted those. Yeah, nobody wanted the lima beans. And the pork slices, I think, were pretty bad. So, those you could usually find somebody that had a bigger appetite to either give them to or trade them for something.
Yeah. And the water supply was relatively adequate?
Well, the water supply, we would fill up with water when we would leave. And I remember that most of us, because we were in the mountains, and would be gone for a couple of weeks, usually before we'd come back into the rear. But we would get supplies. It usually wasn't with water. We would carry two half-gallon soft canteens, and then I think it was a single quart canteen with this, which they seemed to, you know, all the weight adds up, and use those. And then we would take iodine tablets to purify the water. So when we were at a stream or a river, wherever we could find it, and we could fill up and then treat the water, which was always, it was a little bit gross to begin with, and only one time do I remember I did get sick. We had been without water for a couple of days and came upon a bomb crater that was pretty funky, but I remember I did fill a canteen up, and I didn't wait for the iodine to dissolve, and then we were filling up whenever we got to the bad water. We would get some packages from home that had instant Kool-Aid in them. So we would add the Kool-Aid in the water to knock the taste down. Well, I guzzled the canteen, and I don't remember if it was that afternoon or the next day as we were on a patrol, I got lightheaded and actually just pretty much passed out. And I was sick, and we got closer to where they could take me back, and they hauled me back to the rear, and I had gotten some kind of bug from that water and spent a couple of days back in the rear sick. But other than that, that's the only time I really got sick from bad water.
So it tasted bad?
Well, a lot of it tasted bad because it was stagnant and it sat, like in the bomb craters. But if you waited long enough for the iodine tablets to work, you weren't supposed to get sick. And that my problem was on that one. It was my fault. I was just so doggone thirsty that I didn't wait.
Mm-hmm.
I just threw the Kool-Aid in there in the tablet and waited a few seconds and drank it. And that was kind of the end of it.
Well, the supplies, did they come enough? Were you supplied adequately?
I think so. We weren't that far away. We might have been working in the Chulai itself was where our rear area was, which was right on the coastline, and we worked mainly in the flatlands right at the base of the mountain range or in the mountains themselves. And as far as the helicopter goes to get there, it was probably only a matter of 15 minutes, 20 minutes, I think they could get to us fairly fast.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we got resupplied fairly well until the winter time when the monsoon set in. Once in a while it took well because they couldn't get in because of the fog and the rain, and the visibility was so bad they couldn't get to it. But overall, I think we had what we needed.
Talk to me about sleep deprivation. You mentioned just the fact that you would be up a lot. Was that a factor?
It was, and it was really tough. We had it's something you're not used to, and when you're exhausted, and I can remember walking on patrols or moving during the day when we'd have our rucksacks on and our weapons and things, and we would stop for a five-minute break, and basically you would just collapse where you were standing, lean back against your rucksack, and fall sound asleep. It was like that, and easy to do at the time, and then, you know, once we got to where we were going, you would be exhausted, and it would start to get dusk, and I forgot how many would go out at night, probably three or four ambush groups would go out at night, and again, you would take turns staying up, usually two people awake all the time if you could even sleep, anyway, and you would do that all night long until daylight, till you came back in, and then away we'd go again, so we didn't sleep much.
Did other people have a problem with it as well?
Yeah, they all had problems, and more than once, I can remember being on an ambush that everybody would pass the watch from one person to another. I think we would each take, I think, an hour and then pass the watch and wake the next guy up, and then he would do it. Well, more than not, you get somebody in the group that would be so tired they'd advance the time on the watch. So instead of an hour, they might do 45 minutes. Well, if two or three people advanced that thing, the last guy you handed the watch to, he was sitting there for 2 hours wondering what the problem was. It wasn't getting daylight. Well, everybody had advanced the watch that we were using at the time. So that messed it up. And then a few times, I can remember not even being shook awake and handed a watch because the guy before me had fallen sound asleep and we were all sound asleep and daylight would come and, you know, thank God nothing ever happened to us, which had happened to other patrols before. So luckily the times that I knew everybody was falling asleep, we never had any enemy activity anyway.
Talk to me about at night out there. How hard was it for you to adjust to, you know, sleeping out in the jungle and having to deal with everything? We touched on this a bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, just did you acclimate okay? How long did it take you?
And it took a while. After that first night or so, it was just flat miserable. It was, you weren't on a flat surface. You weren't on a anything that was soft to speak of. You know, it was pretty much always a problem as far as what you were laying on. I think I got used to it after a while. We had people bought hammocks, and I bought a hammock once I got into it. But the problem we had with the hammocks, and I never had figured it out until I was about done with my tour, but if it rained so much, if you got yourself in a place where you could put a hammock up, like in a very thick jungle and very thick vegetation, and you got yourself wedged in that thing, you couldn't turn over. You had to kind of lay in one spot on your back. But if it rained, all the rain ran down the tree or whatever you had a hook to, ran down the strings and ran into the hammock, and you were soaked. So it might have kept you off the ground a little bit, but that was also a problem. But I think the point is, Richard, you were just so exhausted, you could pretty much sleep any place.
Mm-hmm. You talked about stopping at night and kind of digging in. Could you describe how you all would dig in and set up a defensive perimeter?
Yes, and that was always a bad one. I hated that. We would, after all day long of doing what we were doing, was just on the move, and whether we had any enemy contact or not, we would get up to a defensive night defensive position, and it was up to us to start digging a trench or a foxhole of some kind for some kind of a defensive position. Well, the last thing anybody wanted to do after we'd been, you know, up all night the night before and all day, and then start digging a hole to get in. So some of the guys would do it. I did it about half the time. And once I got to been there a while, I just decided I just didn't need any part of it, and I didn't dig much. So I let the rest of them dig if they felt more comfortable for it. In fact, we had one instance we had some of the guys had dug, and if I hadn't dug one, I wasn't going to get in one unless it got really bad. But we had some mortar rounds go off that they'd come up on the small hill we were at, and the enemy had popped a few mortars at us, and you could hear them when they hit the tube. And all I did was, when that would happen, I would throw my rucksack over my head and just kind of lay there in a little ball and wait for it to be over. So I wasn't much for digging a hole.
And then night, what were what was the protocol?
And it was the same type of thing as the ambush. We would, depending on what position you were in, you would do with, it was either an hour or 2 hour shifts, with usually we had one person, I think, awake in those, around the perimeter. Once in a while, we would have a starlight scope that you could see at night with. We would pass around. The night before dusk, we would set out our claymore mines, and everybody would kind of figure out what their field of fire was. The sad thing is you couldn't see anything at all. I mean, it was, once it got dark, it was dark. And it never happened to us where we ever got overran or attacked when I was out there and set up on one of those. But it would have been pretty bad because you can't see anything. So, but again, it was just boring trying to stay awake all night till the next morning.
What did you hear at night? What was out there?
Yeah, a lot of noise. We were in an area with a lot of monkeys. We had monkeys you could hear making noise at night. I'm sure there were kind of all kinds of rodents. I don't know if they were rats or gophers or what that would make noise. every now and then at night, especially after we'd had some kind of contact in that day, we would have it where we would, if the noise was wrong, someone would get spooked, either throw a frag at in the direction or open up, you know, with their M16 into the dark. Well, then everybody would wake up in a mad panic, and everybody would, you know, start blasting away in anything, you know, whatever direction they could point there in the dark to the outer side of the perimeter. And usually I think it was probably a monkey or a squirrel or a branch falling out of a tree, or I don't know if it was ever anybody sneaking up on us or not. You know. But that was just kind of, we had an unlimited amount, I guess, when I was there, we never ever worried about ever running out of anything as far as ammunition. You know, you could shoot up all you want, they'd run you some more back out real soon the next day. So you spend a lot of money on nothing.
What kind of animals did you run into out there during the day?
Well, besides the monkeys, I saw a wild boar once running up the side of a hill. We had another wild one that hit one of our, I wasn't within the platoon that had it happen to them, but they had had a boar come through one of their claymore mines coming down a trail. I can recall on one patrol we were walking down the middle of kind of a canal. We were so afraid of the booby traps they kept setting all around us that, you know, we were in the water and walking single file down this canal, and I saw the guys in front of me start scrambling and running from side to side, and then once I got out of the water, looked, there was I think it was an eel. Everybody thought it was a giant leech, but I know it was an eel. Came swimming down through the middle of us, so a lot of gross things in the water, but once he passed us, we all got back in and headed up. Saw a bat a couple of times. We saw bats, and a few snakes. You know, they talk about all these kind of scary snakes, but I don't think I ever saw one that was poisonous.
When you all were going through the terrain on these patrols, what kind of terrain were you on? Did it vary, or
It was a beautiful place we were at. I mean, if you weren't in a war, but outside of the, there was some villages outside of Chulai that were probably mostly PC, but depending on who was visiting the village that day is whose side they were on, so you didn't know. But they were farmers. There was a lot of flatlands there and rice paddies, and then there was the mountain range that went by us. And so if we weren't down in the flatlands, we were up in the mountains, and it was absolutely beautiful. There were waterfalls and you know, green valleys, very lush. But also, once you were up in the mountain areas, it was steep, hard to get around. If we were having troubles with the booby traps and being sniped at and things like that, and we would try to just hack our way with machetes up through the thickest vegetation, we thought they wouldn't have been before the VC as far as steady mines around us. So it was a little tough terrain and part of it, but overall it was probably no worse than anybody else had.
Okay. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the relationships within the unit. How long did it take you to be accepted, and how long did it take for you to make friends, or did you try to make friends within the unit?
I did. I think we touched on it a little bit when I first got to my squad. Mm-hmm. It didn't take me long. You have the friend, you make the friends, especially in your squad you're going to have, and I think you had the respect for the fellas that had been there longer, and in some of them, even if they only had been there a couple of months longer than you had, you pretty much paid attention to what they said. I made friends with some of the other, you didn't get to see some of the other people in the other platoons until we went back into the rear for a couple of days every now and then. Mm-hmm. But I think we talked about racial tensions, and again, we talked about it, but I didn't have any problem with that. So, yeah, and I was never worried about, you always hear about these people not wanting to get close to certain people because you're losing so many, and that, I never even thought of that. I had a lot of friends.
Mm-hmm. Was there any tension between, say, the enlisted or the draftees with the officers?
Not so much. I don't think that it wouldn't have mattered to the draftees or the RAs, which are the regular armies that joined like myself. Some of the officers were really tough to deal with. way too gung-ho for what we wanted. And again, in 1970, 1971, we knew the war was winding down. We knew we were going to be out of there, you know, real soon, and we couldn't win it. So unlike maybe the people that got there in the middle 60s where they thought there was actually going to be an end to it if they could win the thing, we knew there was no end. And so whenever we would get a new second lieutenant, usually is what we'd end up with. And we only got a few.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know anything what they were doing. That was the toughest part, was having them come in and being straight out of school and trying to tell us, you know, how we should do it and what we should do. And they didn't last long. In fact, we had a few of them that we had one I know that did, and since then I've talked, well, we had one incident where we had a new lieutenant show up that nobody really cared for. He was afraid way more than we were for his safety. And we got into a little bit of a firefight, and it didn't last very long. And I can remember looking over, and I saw him kind of wallowing around on the ground holding his foot, and he'd been shot in the top of the foot, which I thought was really strange.
Mm-hmm.
Because where we were all laying, first I thought he shot himself, and I didn't say anything. Well, they dusted him off, and it didn't matter. I did good riddance, because that kind of stuff had happened before. Well, in the last few years, I've met a guy that I knew over there that from the Seattle area, and finally got to the bottom of the story. And this guy was one of the real old timers and was kind of a retired Hell's Angel, one of those fellows that joined the service or went to prison when he was there. But a great guy, and a guy you'd trust your life with, you know, any day. Well, anyway, the second lieutenant had, I don't know what he'd given him, hired him, gave him a bottle of booze or something, but he had hired the fellow to shoot him in the foot when the next time something happened. So, and the guy admitted it finally. And I always knew something was strange, so those kind of things happen, but at least we got rid of the guy. Of course, he probably got his Purple Heart and he's on a disability right now.
Well, I was going to ask you how that made you all feel, and what do you think about that today?
Well, we all answered that. Well, a few of us went up and saw this friend of ours, and I've talked to him a couple of times over the years, and see if he's close here, but I finally asked him, and some of that kind of stuff finally comes out that nobody would talk about that happened, and he finally admitted this, you know, this time that he had done that, because it's, you know, been so many years ago, and basically, to us, it was funny. It was something that, sure, nothing that upset any of us that were standing there getting the story straight.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, I think, those kind of people, they didn't need to be there. They were more of a hindrance, you know, they were just kind of compromising our safety as far as if you've got an inadequate officer with you. So
yeah,
I'm glad he was gone.
What was your relationship with the sergeants and, say, the NCOs?
Yeah, most of them were pretty good. You know, our first sergeant, name was Top Miller. He wasn't in the field much. He kind of took care of what was in the rear, and he was older. And I couldn't stand him then, but I think I look back as I got older and realized he had to do what he was doing as far as forcing the, you know, the people that were faking being sick or, you know, just wouldn't, I guess, toe the line. I mean, if everybody said they weren't going to go to the field, it was up to him to get everybody out into the field and kind of keep things together. So he was doing his job. The other sergeants that we had were just fine. Most of them were just enlisted guys that had been there long enough. They had made some kind of rank. So they were just like anybody else. The only difference with them is they had a little more time on us. And when we went back into the rear to spend a couple of days, they got to go to the NCO club and the rest of us didn't. So.
What about any discussion of fragging?
You always heard of that. And that happened more to the people that were in the rear a lot. And even the time I was in the rear, I don't think I ever saw it happen. So you always heard of it happening, but in our unit, I never saw it happen as far as the officers that we had. I don't think anybody really... Well, I don't think we had anybody hated that much. But also, though, and I think we touched on it earlier, is what had changed was when I was there, it had gotten so bad in the rear area that when we would come back in off of the helicopters would bring us back in from being out for a couple of weeks, they would get us on the on some deuce and a half trucks, and when we would get back to the rear area, before we could get off the truck, the armorer and the first sergeant were there, and they would take all our weapons, all our frags, anything that we had. I mean, you probably could have hid something, but we had no weapons or anything in the rear as they did in the, you know, earlier on in the war.
Mm-hmm.
That's just because of that, I think, the fragging and the problems that were happening.
Tell me about back in the rear at base camp and what that life was like. What
well,
would you
I love
all
that.
Do?
Yep. That's the only thing that kind of kept me going through most of it. Being on China Beach area, but the whole thing was China Beach.
Mm-hmm.
But we had these big long, what they'd call hooches, but they were basically just big plywood buildings that would hold probably 30 or 40 of us, or I think there might have been more, and some of them. Some were smaller, some were larger. But ours, in our area, we were very fortunate because they were right on the beach. We had a shower room that was real close there that was a bunch of barrels that they had water in that would just kind of come out the bottoms of them from gravity feed, take a shower. They had a enlisted men's club right there, which was what we probably all just lived for the couple of weeks we were out in the bush. And they actually had a chow hall, so we could go over there and have kind of regular food while we were in the rear. Plus, you know, you got clean clothes and pretty much no duty. Anybody that was in the field when we came back in, they were, because they had such a thing as perimeter guard as far as the rear area, which was a huge compound. And a lot of the fellas that were in for other, had other jobs that never got to the field, I think, had to do that. But we pretty much were left alone for a couple, 3 days at a time when they come back in the rear.
What about racial tensions back in the back?
That was bad. Again, I never had any with the people that I really knew that were in our company, but it was bad enough that if you were at night, you wouldn't leave your company area, say if you had a friend that was a half a mile away or an eighth of a mile in another company or whatever it might be, you wouldn't go by yourself, which was I can't believe how bad that is to even hear me saying now, because that was terrible. It shouldn't have been that way.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah, it was the blacks and the whites. And, but again, in the latter 60s, when all the things were happening back home, it was carrying over. And then the frustration of the war was happening, and it was supposedly it was the white man's war, and it wasn't good. We had one instance that I'd written a story about earlier, but we had whenever we would come back into the rear area, a lot of times they would have what they'd call a floor show or a band for us. And we would go to the enlisted men's club, and this one instance we had a Australian band was there, and a couple of, you know, pretty Australian girls, and they were playing the regular 60s rock and roll, and our company was in there with our lieutenant and company commander and whoever was there, and actually it was mixed. There were a few of the fellows, the black fellows in our company were in there. Well, as I noticed that around this EM club, slowly but surely, black soldiers, you could tell they were rear echelon guys because they had such clean, starchy type fatigues and stuff on, and started mingling in, and they were standing all around the back of this big building, which was where this kind of what we call the floor show was going on.
Mm-hmm.
They started, you know, bad mouthing the band as far as what the music was, and there wasn't any soul and on and on. So we were trying to ignore it, and everybody had been drinking quite a bit, but next thing we know, one of them walked up, and one of the good fellow, well, guy in my squad, one of the rear echelon black guys came walking up and took a half smoked cigarette and dropped it in Wimpy Boudreaux's beer can, and it was like slow motion. I can remember looking over there at this guy standing over him and got a couple of words, and when he dropped that, he let go of that cigarette, and it headed for that beer can. The minute it hit that beer can, it's like a bomb went off in that place. It's like chairs flew, tables flew, fists were flying, and it was kind of like you see on TV. I mean, everything was, it was just chaos there for about 3 or 4 minutes, you know, in a barroom brawl.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all just because it was the racial thing again.
Mm-hmm.
But here we were in for, you know, a couple of days from the field, and the fellas that started it were in the rear all the time, but it was, you know, the majority of us were the white guys, and they were out to prove a point, and of course, again, then they shut the EM club down and made us stay in our company area and hauled us back out to the bush, so we got kind of penalized for it.
How did that affect morale?
It was bad. And it got worse from there on out. And we had a couple of guys go to the hospital after that fight that were pretty important to us, good friends. I think it was just another thing that made it worse as far as even the black fellas in our company. A lot of them decided they weren't going to go out anymore. They were not going to go out to the bush anymore. And then once they said they weren't going to go, some of the white guys said they weren't going to go. And the lieutenant I had, in fact, I'm going to see here next month, that I carried a radio for, named Bob Amos. He was the XO at the time. And I talked to him later, and I didn't know what happened, but he said it got to the point where he had to send three of them to Long Bend Jail, which was the prison there in Vietnam, just because they kept refusing orders. Mm-hmm. He said it got to the, and he's a great guy, the nicest guy in the world, and do anything for anybody. But he said it got to the point where you can only give somebody a direct order so many times, and that was it. And so three of them I know of that were in our group ended up in prison over there.
Wow. So when you got back out to the field, did mm-hmm. this stuff carry over, or was it left back in the rear?
Most of it was left back in the rear. We had some of the fellows that weren't a problem at all, and kind of like me, too. We had a few southern of the white guys that were just as bad, but it really didn't carry over. But a lot of them weren't there. The real troublemakers had already been hauled off to prison that we'd had in our group.
Mm-hmm.
We even had one of the fellows, pretty good guy, one of the old-timers, but he was kind of squirrely, but I'm never forgetting his name, Jay Montgomery, and this is something I could always tell because it wasn't that big a deal, but he refused to go to the field because the rest of a lot of the black guys didn't go. Well, one day we're out in the field, we look up, and here comes a resupply helicopter, and he's a little short guy with red curly hair, and look up, and he gets off the helicopter, and they throw the supplies off, and I'm looking at him, he doesn't have anything. He's got his jungle hat on, and his shirt, and his pants, and I don't think anything else. Well, what had happened was the first sergeant, Topham, got so mad at him, he hauled him out to the resupply, threw him on a helicopter, and away they came, and he came out with no rucksack, no food, no weapon, no nothing, and pretty much just wandered around with us for another 4 or 5 days, so we went back.
Wow. That's tough.
So, yeah, that's still, we just, and we haven't seen, one of the guys saw him a few years after we got back, and I don't know where he's at now, but that's one of the stories we tell yearly at our reunions.
Oh, yeah.
Jay Montgomery coming out there with nothing but a pack of cigarettes in his pocket.
So. Let me ask you, changing subjects.
Mm-hmm.
When you did engage the enemy, can you describe who they were and what you ran into?
We had... rarely did I ever see him. We talked earlier about Davenport in my squad that shot an NVA officer. That mm-hmm. was the first one I saw. We also had another instance when we had somehow trapped a person in a little, I think it would be like a coconut grove, and everybody had surrounded them and killed a couple of, I think it was one or two VC in there, and that was kind of unnerving. We had one instance, I remember I was walking second man from point where we came around a corner, and they were two VC, and they had a stretcher, which was like with a pole and kind of a canvas sack with a third one in it. And we saw them, and they saw us, and they dropped him like a hot potato and took off running down the hillside. And this poor guy they dropped, we were just as shocked as they were to see them. He had apparently stepped on one of their own toe popper landmines because he didn't have a foot. And I can remember him scrambling up through the brush as fast as he could go without a foot.
Mm.
We finally caught up to him, and it was this one we actually sent him back, but I can remember, this is one of my memories, is that when we got there to him, he'd flipped over on his back and he was praying. And I don't know, because I remember he was kind of chanting. He was, I thought we were going to kill him right then, and he had his arms stuck up in the air. And we didn't. You know, we picked him up and hauled him back to a place, and I think they sent a helicopter out to take him back to interrogate him.
Mm-hmm.
So... But as far as NVA regulars, I never saw any. We'd run into these VCs, like those instances, and I had some other instances where we would defeat the Viet Cong, but never, luckily, I never ran into to any full-fledged NVA regiment where we engaged them.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Viet Cong. What were their strengths and weaknesses?
Well, theirs was they were so mobile. They could move so fast. They were experts in for us in setting landmines around us. Most of the people said, you know, if there was a landmine out there, we were going to find it because we always were stepping on them. It was just a weekly thing. We keep losing people to mines and toe poppers. Mm-hmm. I think that, and they were so creative. They didn't have anything. Their food was bad. I mean, the food was in short supply. Medical was short supply. And I think they may have had more of a motivation to win than we did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's amazing that we could have lost the war from what we had, but I tend to think mobility, and there was a dedication to what they were doing, unlike us.
What kind of weapons do they use mostly? Was it, were they booby traps?
Well, for booby traps, and then what usually would be, you could tell the AK-47 would be the Russian rifles that they had.
Mm-hmm.
But again, in the areas we were at, there'd only be, as I recall, there might be two or three VC and only like one weapon between them, and that they would, you know, be harassing us every now and then. They'd sneak up on us and, you know, shoot a clip or two and then take off running, and we'd never find those guys. So,
did you make any effort to chase them or go after them?
Usually not. No, we usually never ever went down and tried to run anybody down. We want to stay out of harm's way. So we. It was one of those things that if they took off running in a certain direction, we were so afraid, too, that you'd either be pulled into an ambush, step on a booby trap. We didn't go out of our way to make contact, I guess.
Right. And is that because you wanted, I guess you just said, keep safe, you know, don't hurt yourself, but also because of your attitude toward the war?
Attitude toward the war is what happened. If we made contact, we could call in, you know, the Cobra gunships or artillery. We would call in a lot of times, and they could just, you know, bomb the heck out of a certain hillside or area. Who knows if anybody was ever in that area or not, but we had to guess they were there. But as far as us physically trying to run people down, that we thought, boy, that was rare. I don't remember more than a couple of times that we were ever used or ever would do it. As far as just, it was just too risky. Our whole goal there was to come home at that time.
Yeah. Well, can you describe some of the times you did run at the enemy? And you've already talked about this a bit, but just your experience with combat in general. What can you say about it?
Everybody has their own little snippet of what happened. And we talked about the one on my first day out. What you see and what the fellow five steps from you sees are completely different things. And I've run into that over the years, and it's kind of helped seeing all my old friends again, because we can put some of these stories together on things we all went through. Most of it was chaotic. Most of the firefights I was in were very short, because it would be just, and short as in not a, I don't even know if they'd even last minutes. It would just, because seconds, when bullets are flying is a long time. I know when I was carrying the radio for, Lieutenant Amos, some of the fellows didn't want to carry the radio because of the weight. Some of them didn't want to carry it because you were, a lot of times if they were snipers out there, they would figure out who the lieutenant was the leader or the radio man. If they could get them first, that would compromise the whole group or the whole patrol. And one instance for sure I can remember too, and we got off the helicopters and we were heading down a trail quickly we got opened up on, and they were after me, because I could hear when they opened up, you'd hear a crack, 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 and a split second later you could hear a zing, 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 and it'd be the bullet tumbling over you. And I don't know, they probably missed me by a couple of feet, but they were buzzing by my head, and I know it's because I had the radio. It was the antenna. And again, I dropped to the ground and threw my rucksack on my head and just lay there and got through that one. So,
how does it feel to be targeted?
Well, that was the only time I had. I got to admit, the only time I think they really, I was really the one that they were trying to get. And it feels fine now, but at the time it was kind of unnerving. And I think that because I had one of the fellows that was leading country when I came in had been an RTO, and his souvenir was he had the little screw-in base of the antenna that had sat right by his ear that they had shot and shot the thing off right next to his ear. And he kept that little screw-in stub that went into the top of the radio kind of as a memento about how close it came. And it's a real different feeling knowing somebody's trying to kill you, you know, in that sense. And, but lucky to say, that's the only time I ever remember them really doing it. I think I was more afraid. I was more afraid of booby traps any day than I would be getting shot.
Yeah. What else about combat? Anything stand out as far as incidents that occurred?
Well, the biggest one that probably, I guess, was the most traumatizing time I had. We had a we were on a patrol in an area that we weren't real familiar with, and we had our company commander, which I've seen since, so he's a real good guy, his name's Bob Franco. We were in an area that he wasn't real familiar with, from what I learned later, that we'd been sniped at off and on, and spent the afternoon trying to get to the top of this one hill to set up a defensive perimeter for the night. And it was a slow, strenuous type of a climb up this and being shot at every now and then. Luckily, nobody was hit. Well, we started getting up towards the top and fanning out around this thing, and I can remember hearing the radio go off that there was a resupply helicopter in the area, and they had some chocolate milk, and they thought they'd drop it off. And again, this chocolate milk's the kind of stuff that never spoiled, but still it was better than nothing. So we got to the top of this thing, and we only had two platoons, I think, at the time, because there was so few of us, but most of us got to the top, and one of our Kit Carson scouts, which would be a Viet Cong type that came over to our side and was actually kind of our guide and interpreter and so on, had seen something in the brush at the top of this hill, and I didn't know it. This I didn't know at the time. This is all I heard after that. But anyway, he hit what it was when he walked over to it, he hit a tripwire. And this tripwire, once this explosion went off, I didn't know it at the time, but I was knocked down, and most of the people were knocked down. There was dust all over. And it was dead silent for maybe a split few seconds because of what had happened. And then it's one of those things you can never forget, that the groaning and the screaming and the hollering started. And what had happened was, well, I sat up. I was okay. I just had been knocked down. But what had happened was is they had set up a what they called a daisy chain and filled up three big canisters, I think from artillery rounds, around this perimeter we were standing on, and it filled them full of glass and rocks and metal, and these three canisters that surrounded the top of this hill we were on all exploded at the same time where we all were. So I remember squad leader James, I'd only been, this was in the end of July, so I'd been in the field just about a month at this one. And I can remember James, because we'd been harassed and shot at all the way up, screaming at me, and then he threw the M60 machine gun down and told me to get it and sit in the one trail, but his first thought was that once they had been harassing us and sniping at us, once we had been get hurt as bad as we had, we thought we may be attacked from them. So most of the fellas were up scrambling, helping the dead and the wounded that had come about. And I never knew how many there was. You could see, people around, and bandages were going this way and that way. And pretty soon the helicopters came in one after another, the medevacs, taking people away. And when finally everything cleared for the wounded, we'd kind of figured out we'd had six dead and 27 wounded just off of that one booby trap. So it was coming to be dusk. And over the years, I found out a little more about this. Well, we were afraid to move. When you lose that many people on one mine, we were, some of the helicopters came in and started hauling off some of the people that weren't wounded. And so I know our company commander and some of the other people were hauled off. And as I recall, there were about 8 or 9 of us that were left up there, and we were waiting for another 2 helicopters to come back. Well, we got a call on the radio that they'd either pull them to go somewhere else or were going to leave us there that night. And that was probably the most unnerving thing, because there we were. There were, I think, barely a squad of us left. The enemy knew that with all those medevacs coming in and out, how many of us were hurt, how many were gone, and probably how few were still on the hill, and we were told we've got to stay there. So we sat. I can remember sitting back to back. I don't think I moved more than about 2 feet the rest of that evening, and thinking that they were going to come any time. And that evening, I can remember, at the dark, when it was dark, way down the bottom of the hillside, we could see a couple little tiny fires. Well, a lot of times the enemy would cook at night, eat at night. They weren't really afraid of much. But we knew they were down there, and we thought, well, it's a matter of time until they're going to come up. Luckily, nothing. They didn't come up, but we were afraid to go down. Well, we got a radio call the next day, as they wanted our group to move to another hill, which is, I forgot how many clicks or it would be away, but they wanted us to take and hook up and move to another hill. Well, we weren't going to go anywhere. Number one, we were afraid to move in case there was more booby traps. We knew the enemy was down the bottom of the hill, and they probably knew how few of us they were. So we refused. We refused a direct order on the radio. And I can remember James, squad leader, trying to get us together and say, look, you know, here's what we got to stick together, because if we go down there, we're probably not going to get through this. So we did, and we got probably another hour or two. Out comes a little Loach helicopter, one of the real small ones, and it had a colonel on it. I forgot who he was. He came out. He walked around there and told us everything was fine, and ordered us to go down the hill and hook up with it was called Bravo Company, was a ways away. And again, we all stuck together and refused to go, and we were threatened to go to prison and the dawn and on and on. And they said, well, we're not moving. So you know, he got back in his helicopter and he left. And I don't know if it was an hour or so later, I look up and here comes a chaplain gets off. And he comes over and tells us that you guys are in big trouble. If you don't, you know, obey this order, you're all going to jail. And he, same thing. And we all checked in and said, we're not leaving. You know, we're not moving off this hill for anybody. You know, it's stupid. He left to no avail, and we're still sticking together, not knowing if we're going to spend another night up there, just so few of us, when everybody's in the rear. And pretty soon they bring out a mine dog. Another helicopter shows up, and it's got a guy with a German Shepherd, because we kept telling them we were afraid of mines because of what happened to us. And the mine dog and the handler show up and wander around the hill and says we couldn't find any. And, well, it didn't matter to us because we didn't want to go down the hill. That was, you know, half the point with mines. The other half was we knew the enemy was down there, and we weren't going down there, but 8 of us or whatever it was, or 9. And so he left, and we thought, well, that'll be the end of it. We're probably all going to jail or going at least into the rear, and they're going to, you know, have us up on some kind of charges. And this had been going on all day, and this is the next day after we'd lost all those people. And it was just, we didn't quite know who was dead and who was wounded. We just knew we'd lost so many. And the next day, here comes a couple of Huey helicopters, and we thought, well, this is it. You know, we're going back, and sure enough, we get on the helicopters and think we're heading back to Chu Lai, and they took them about 3 minutes in the air to fly us over to Bravo Company, drop us off, and leave us there where they wanted us to walk to. And that's where we stayed. So nothing ever happened. No charges filed. Nobody ever got in trouble. We made it. We were safe, as far as safe, because there was a few of us that took us to another company. But something they should have done, you know, that night after we lost so many, or the next day, instead of trying to make us walk down through that again. So a little bit of a bitter taste, and you know, it's one of those deals that we got a bunch of new guys after that, so that's a whole other story. But that's the one big thing, I think, that we lost so many, you know, in such a short amount of time.
That had to be incredibly difficult on morale and continuing on. Was that the case?
That was. In fact, I had one of the fellows that I see at the reunions, and I'm going to see again next month, was one of the few that was left up there with me. And we were so bitter because they had hauled most of the, of course, the dead and wounded were gone, but the rest of the company, for a long time I thought that we were the only ones that had never gotten hurt. Then I realized after some of these reunions, I talked to the guys, that they had started to evacuate and are moving the other people and just either ran out of time or ran out of birds for all of us. So it was really upsetting to me that they would leave us out there, and I guess we were just numbers. But still bitter about it then, and is why we refused these direct orders. I'm still kind of bitter about it now. I don't know. I don't know. That was it's one of the most traumatic, times I had. It wasn't long after that that I had my one stand where I decided that, I'd seen so many of us die, and here it was the end of July, and I'd only been out there for, 6 weeks, not even 6 weeks, and all of a sudden I'm one of the old-timers, because we get all these brand-new guys come in to fill all these positions or to replace all the bodies that are gone, and all of a sudden I'm one of the older types around there. And I decided that I'd had a uncle that had been in a similar situation where he'd lost a bunch of people in a firefight. In fact, he won the Bronze Star for Valor in it, but he couldn't take it anymore, and he wasn't going to die there. So he went back and reenlisted to get a rear area job, and just wasn't going to die there. So at that time, I'd made a decision that I said, I went to the company commander, I think it was the lieutenant, Bob Amos, because he didn't happen to be there at that time, which is he still feels kind of bad about it. I said, I'm not going to die out here. I don't have to prove anything, so I'm going to go back in there. I'm going to reenlist because I'm not staying out here anymore. And so luckily, I went back in on a helicopter with another fellow that had been there the same amount of time I had. I didn't care who thought what. I just had figured out that it wasn't worth dying in that country for that. And when we got to the reenlistment office, first thing the guy asked what our MOSs were, which were tankers, but really infantry. And he said, sorry, the program they had where if you reenlisted to pick a job that you wanted, anybody who had a combat MOS could not reenlist again, because everybody that was, there was so many trying to do it to get out of the field, they needed people in the field. So that afternoon, we're back on the same helicopter and dumped back in the field, and I'm thinking, man, I'm never going to live through this. So, but I did.
Were you bitter?
I think I was bitter. I think I was bitter, but I think I was more resigned that I was going to lose a foot or lose a leg or, die. And really for nothing. It was just, because at this point it was just senseless. And I used to, kind of mentally, I would keep kind of a tally on the losses on their side and our side for our crew. And if you counted wounded people, not necessarily that were died as far as our group goes, we always lost. We might have gotten a couple of them through ambushes or claymore mines, but always we lost people to booby traps, weekly. So if you were taking a count on who was winning, we were losing as far as bodies and what happened to us. So that I got back out to the company, and I think that's when I started carrying the radio, was after that. And that's when I had the few more close calls carrying the radio. But it was just adapted to what I needed to do just to get through it.
Did you try to not, think about what had happened? Try to put that out of your mind?
Well, the problem with what had happened was you didn't realize who was dead and who had died. A couple of the fellows that weren't hurt too bad came back. But the one real good friend I had, this was a black friend of mine, Jesse Hill from Tennessee. I didn't know if he had died or not. A few of the other fellows that I was friends with, he didn't know if they died or not. Because what happened was they hauled them all off to three different hospitals. There were so many. And from there, they took them to Japan, the ones that were really bad. And so you never know who died or not. And for the next, number of days or weeks, just the thought of not knowing who was dead, who was, all of them that were, there were so many that were gone. You didn't know if they had died or were wounded or what. That was the toughest part. I didn't know. luckily, the at Jesse Hill, I was able to find a number of years ago, and he'd spent months and months and months in Japan in the hospital, but we've been able to get together two or three times, and he's okay.
So why couldn't you all find out what had happened? Just because you were back out, they were medevaced out, and that was
yeah. And if you look at the way they kept records back then, because when they took them all to the hospital, they took them to three different hospitals back there, and then the real bad ones they somehow got them stabilized and they hauled them to Japan. Well, there was really no way or nobody to ask if they were on the way to Japan what happened to them, and we were still in the field anyhow. And there was really no way to find it. And I, back in, I think, 1995, I still didn't know what happened to a lot of them. In 1995, I was became aware there was an AmeriCal Veterans Association through a friend of my wife's that was in it. And at the time, computers were coming on board, but there wasn't a lot of this online website type thing. And they had a little magazine, and I put a little blurb in there in it, and I said I was looking for a certain person and a certain incident that happened, and I named off a couple of people, and I also named off this big booby trap we hit where we lost so many. And never heard anything. Well, I got a package. In fact, I've got it on my desk here, the letter. But I got a package and a letter, and in it was a like an 8x10 glossy photograph and a 2-page letter from a chaplain. And the chaplain was the chaplain that they brought out in the field a couple of days after this had happened, and not the one that tried to get us to go off the hill, but after this happened. And he's also the chaplain that ran from hospital to hospital, and he sent me a list, a handwritten list of who he was able to see, what hospital they were at, and he's the one that actually told me what the booby traps were. And in that 8x10 glossy, I'm looking, and there I am. I'm sitting in the forefront of this thing, kind of looking down as he's giving a service. And that was a real strange thing to see, is, yourself, 18 years old, 2 days after that it happened, sitting there in the dirt, on the top of this hill in Vietnam. Somebody actually had that picture.
What'd you look like?
Oh, shaggy head, baby faced kid. I was always griping about getting haircuts. We were pretty somber. It was, it was a very somber mood with that, because he was given a service, and I wasn't never been overly religious at all, but it was a thing where it was just a real downer. I mean, the whole thing was a downer. We'd lost them all, and everywhere, kind of supposed to kind of suck it up and keep going on. So.
Do you think that they should have put you guys on stand down and just? I mean, this is horribly traumatic.
Yeah, I don't think they didn't, because what happened was when they flew the few of us, they didn't take off that hill over to that other company. They brought back the rest of the company that was left, and then. That's when I think we stayed on this another little defensive perimeter hill in another area. But I can remember them flying in on the resupply birds, all these new guys. And we had new guy after new guy after new guy. Just keep getting them and splitting them up. And I got some real good friends that came in after that I see, yearly and correspond with, monthly. Mm-hmm. That came in that were part of the replacements for all the people that we lost. So, but yeah, we didn't really get any kind of a break. And I almost think that maybe there would be a reason for that, because I got to tell you, Richard, I think there were probably half of people, we wouldn't have gone back. When you lose, when you go through something like that, I think if we would have got back in the rear, they would have had more problems with us. They would have brought us back.
Right. So they would just want to basically put you out there and let you all deal with it on your own.
And that's pretty much, I think, what we did. I think we were so spooked there for a few days, we probably shot, $10,000 worth of ammunition up, every couple of days just on shooting at sounds and stuff. Time seems to heal, and as the days and the months went on, everything, we got back to the same old routine. But that was the biggest thing I was ever involved in.
How do you feel about it today?
Well, it still makes me mad that they probably, if we wouldn't have stuck together and refused that direct order and didn't come out there and keep trying to get us to go down that hill, I think we probably all would have gotten killed. I think that... Yeah, I'm almost sure that we would have not been here today, and that makes me mad. You know, they, with all of the helicopters they had there, they wasted time. You know, with those sending the colonel out and the chaplain out and the mine dog guy out. You know, three different trips they came out there trying to make us move off that hill, and instead of just sending the two helicopters like they finally did later that day to shuttle us over, it took them 4 or 5 minutes to get over to another hill. So, you know, it shouldn't have been. You know, they weren't looking out for their people, as far as I'm concerned, on that one.
So you're mad at them for trying to get you out, not mad at yourself and the others for refusing the direct order?
Oh, not at all. No. As far as refusing the direct order, that was absolutely the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there comes a point when you have to, what's right and what's wrong. You see all these, Audie Murphy movies when people are jumping up and charging head on into a machine gun. Well, we weren't into that. So the smart thing for us to do was to either stay put, and because we knew what was going to happen if we went down the hill, and we were just going to let the dice, roll the dice if they were going to try to do something to us legally. And I don't think they even wanted to. I don't think they wanted to mess with any of the legal stuff. I think they got frustrated with us by refusing that order. But I think to them, I think maybe they deep down knew it, that, how can you make, 8 or 9 guys do that after they'd lost, 6 dead and 27 wounded around them the night before? So, but no, I don't feel bad at all. We did the right thing.
It sounds like you did.
Yeah.
I would like, if you could, tell me about the mental state of being in a war zone. You talked about what you thought of the war at the time. You talked about, these very serious combat incidents that you experienced. But in general, is there a kind of an overriding fear or something hanging over your head every day? And this is besides the feeling that you weren't going to survive. But is there something that you all felt in common with this environment? This is highly irregular, unusual, not what people experience usually in their life. And here you are right in the middle of it. Can you comment on that?
Well, the only thing I guess I've always thought over the years is that being so young, and I think the average age of the soldier over there was probably 19 or 20. I was 18, I think. To me, that had a lot to do with us adapting. I mean, the morale was down. I don't remember ever being, when a firefight would start or someone would step on a mine, I can remember being, very afraid. But morale-wise, I can remember even some of the times having some very funny and fun experiences, out in the field. And I always told people that most of the time we never talked about anything until about the last 10 years, till anybody's ever even opened up about things that we did. But I always told people, we had a whole lot of good times and a few bad times over there. And I don't know. I think I was able to adapt with it. I think most of the guys that were over there that I knew, we just did what we had to do and just took it one day at a time until we could come home. I don't really know what to say about it.
Okay. You've described a lot of the tactics that you guys used, and one of them was the ambush, and also trying to avoid an ambush. Can you tell me how you all would set up an ambush?
Most of ours, when we would go out for night ambushes, which I always thought was just backwards of what we should do, but we would go out at dusk, and we were obvious. So if the enemy ever wanted to watch us and watch where we were going to go, and it happened to some other squads I know where they did get overrun and attacked in their ambush site, but it was easy to see us because we always made way too much noise whether we tried to or not, and we would go out 4 or 5. As I recall, into the dusk, find where we were supposed to be, which was not always where we would end up. We would pick a spot, usually around what we think some heavily used trail, and we could set our claymore mines out, which are the ones with the tripwires, and shoot the little steel pellets out that would cover a broad area. to one of those up on each direction of the trail, and then we would kind of spread ourselves out a little bit in between that area, off to the side, off to one, all of us on one side of the trail, and, you know, wait. And really only one time that I was involved in one is where we had anything very serious happen, and we had a had set up for the evening, and it kind of all kind of hunkered down, and all of a sudden we heard some talking and some jabbering. Well, what it was some Viet Cong were walking down this trail right towards us. Well, that's, your heart's about to pound out of your chest at the time, and that's going to happen. And in a matter of just a few seconds, they were up on us, and they had hit the tripwire. So there's a big explosion and a little bit of silence, and then there's all kinds of hollering and jabbering and screaming going on with them. Well, again, I think it was James, which was kind of always the solid head case around us, made sure, told us all to be quiet. We couldn't, and the reason was we couldn't see anything. So they didn't know we were there, but we knew they were there, and if we would have started opening up in the dark, who knows if they would have seen the muzzle flashes or whatever, and usually they would have what they call Chi-Com grenades that they could throw or whatever it might be. So we sat tight, let the hollering and the screaming go on for a little bit because we knew at least one of them was down, and pretty soon they were gone, and it was quiet. And this was probably not long before dusk. And we hadn't made a move, hadn't made a noise. We decided we would just wait and get up in the morning, or not get up, we were going to stay awake. So it got to be daylight. And when we walked over to where the one had gone off, what the two things that were laying off the side of the trail were a couple of feet cut off right about the ankle. And what had happened was, it was the first guy in line, and there was no sandals or anything. I'm half under barefoot. But, whoever said it, I don't think it wasn't me, but whoever said it kind of low. And when this claymore went off, it sheared the feet both off. So we had two dirty feet laying off to the side of the trail. And we followed the bloodline for a while where they carried them off. We never did find him. But when the rest of the, we called it in, and when the rest of the platoon came down, we had a fellow that was absolutely crazy. He probably shouldn't have been anywhere, even around him. We called him Wild Man, and he was a real strange duck. And had squirrely looking hair and had one tooth, and it was just, he was just bizarre. But we had everybody carried an Instamatic camera with him at the time. And I can remember Wild Man, he walked over there and picked up those feet, one in each hand, by the big toe, and stood there holding them out to each side of them with this big one-tooth grin on his face. And he must have taken 50 pictures of that screwball with these 2 feet. And I think he finally talked to him in the brush. We packed up our stuff and headed out. But I'd kept that picture for a few years afterwards. And I think when I dug, about 10 years after I'd, not that long, a few years after I'd gotten back, you know, some people keep some of that stuff. I went through some of those pictures I had, and I talked, and that was, to me, that I got enough of a visual in my mind, a Wild Man and those 2 feet that I need, so I don't need the picture. But that's one ambush where we did get somebody. But again, we weren't, you know, maybe in the earlier on in the war, and maybe in different wars, that would have happened, and we would have, you know, charged and started throwing grenades and doing whatever we needed to do, but we were there just to get out of the place. So, you know.
Were their ambushes successful? How often did you all run into those?
Well, luckily, I never really did. It got anything except being, they opened up on us as far as the small arms fire a lot. And it didn't last very long, so they would open up, and it would last for a number of seconds, probably, is all it was, and we would return fire, and it was over fairly fast. We would call in gunships to start shooting rockets where we thought they might be. So their ambushes, luckily, I never ever was around anybody that, except that one lieutenant that I know of, the other fellow shot in the foot, that ever, I saw anybody ever get shot in one that I was involved with. Again, it was all landmines and booby traps with us.
Were you ever wounded?
No. Luckily, you know, I had a, I don't know why. It was one of those things on that big booby trap where we lost so many, and you know, I had a fella, you know, one in front of me once and one behind me that stepped on a toe popper and lost their feet, and just had a lot of things happen there, and I just nothing ever. I never got the only time I ever got a scratch, I got a little scar, and that was from a, after we'd hit the big booby trap one of those spooky nights when I thought I'd heard something like everybody else. It was my turn for guard, and it was probably a rogue, but I can remember rolling a, you know, you hollered frag out when you were going to throw a hand grenade or a frag out into where it was going to go, and I don't know why, everybody was pretty much asleep or trying to. Mm-hmm. I didn't throw it out far enough, and when it did blow up, I did, a little piece of shrapnel just kind of set on my wrist, but other than that, nah, you know. Besides getting shot at close to and things like that, I was very fortunate. I was too one of the lucky ones after jumping ahead. But most of the time, a lot of us, the longer you're in there, rear area jobs would open up. And if you could survive your first so many months, they would always take the old timers if you were making it. And if there any kind of job came into the opened up in the rear area, you could go back. So I was lucky enough. The last few months I had, I got to go back in the rear and handle the mail for the company. So
back at True Life.
Yeah, yeah, which was a cushy thing. In fact, it was I told my lieutenant that I thanked the world of named Bob Amos. That I see a lot. He doesn't remember hardly any of it. Of course, he had a lot of guys to take care of, but he was one of those that he happened to be on R&R visiting his wife in Hawaii when we hit the big booby trap. And he was just coming back to the company when it happened to us. He wasn't with us. And I talked to him a few years back. He said he still feels some guilt about not being there with us. And, you know, we're glad he wasn't. I mean, I would have hated something to happen to him. But when after that happened, I can remember one instance. There was what we called a 3-day R&R come up, and it was up in China Beach in Da Nang. And he chose me to go, probably because he probably figured I was shook up enough and the youngest guy out there. But that was nice. And so I got 3 days out of that. He got to be the what we called the XO in the company, because usually officers only spent 6 months out in the field, and then they could find him another job in the rear. That's what they got to do. And I can remember that he was back doing his XO duties, and the mail clerk, who was also had been an RTO, was going to go home pretty soon. And I remember him asking me if I knew how to type. Well, I really didn't. I took one course, you know, in high school, my sophomore year, and I could type with two fingers. But I said, hell yeah, I can type anything you want. So I got to do the mail clerk job. So I was able my last few months to stay in the rear and handle the mail, and which what I was kind of told him, I said, whether he knows it or not, he could have saved my life. You know, a couple times of getting me out of the field. Who knows if the next day you were going to get it or not. And I was lucky enough to come back. And most of us, I can't recall hardly, just a very few guys that were with us ever spent their entire 12 months out there. I know only one that I do know we get together with did, but most of the people that I was with, if you could make it through anywhere to 6 to 8 to 10 months, whatever it might be, and you had any kind of brain to you at all to do any kind of thing, whether drive a truck or clerical or we had a couple of fellows go back into the headquarters and run the radios and do things. There was a way you could get yourself out of the field after. You couldn't do it when you were new, but towards the end. And most of the fellows I know were able to come back and get some kind of a rear job.
And it was a huge transition.
Oh, huge. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, it was such a relief when that finally would happen to you. And I watched guys all around me do it. And in fact, I had a fellow that was one of the new guys after the mine. He wrote and told me he remembers the day that I got mine as far as the rear job. He remembered when I was leaving. But it was a thing. You've actually got a place to sleep. You're pretty much out of harm's way. You know, once in a while they shoot rockets into our compound. But boy, after if you'd ever been out as a grunt, who cares? I mean, they'd shoot rockets and we'd hear them coming in, and most of the guys that had been in the field wouldn't even move. You'd lay there in your bed. And once you've been out in the field, nothing was going to faze you. So it was nice to have a mess hall. You know, nice to go to the EM clubs and the NCO clubs or whatever you were at, and just kind of bide your time to get out of there.
Before we move back to the rear,
yeah.
You did mention an R&R. Was that your only one?
I took two in Bangkok. Yeah, I just enjoyed those. I'd like to go back. It's just a beautiful country and beautiful people, and the food was good, the people were friendly, spent a lot of money and drank a lot, but it was a nice way to get away from it all, but a very strange transition, because you go from I can recall when the guys would go wherever they chose to go, be it Australia or Thailand or Hawaii, you would usually get out of the field just the day before you left, and so you would be on a helicopter getting back into the rear area to change your clothes, to be flown somewhere to get on a jet, and within about 24 hours, you were standing in some fancy hotel somewhere.
Right.
I mean, what a transition. So, it had a good time, but it was just a strange, strange thing.
Mm-hmm. Did you take anybody with you on your own?
No, I always met a buddy to hang out with. You know, I would always was, you know, enough to meet him. Well, I guess the second time I did, it was one of the fellows, the last name was Spencer. I've never been able to find him since, but he was from the same rear area as our company was. And we went together and spent the time together and shared it. We had a driver who would drive us all over the place. And, you know, went to some Thai boxing shows and went and saw elephants and mainly ate a lot. You know, we tried to eat a lot. And remember one of the times in the hotel we were at, there was a huge crowd of Thai schoolgirls were there, and they were there to see a rock and roll group called Marmalade. I forgot what it was called, Reflections of My Life. I'll never forget that. It had a big 60s hit, but it's something I kind of remember. Yeah, the people were, you know, the people were nice. They, of course, we were spending a lot of money there, too. So.
Right.
But if I had to do it again, I would probably try to, I would never got to go to Australia. I think I'd go to Australia. Just because the people there like us, and I never get to be a part of the country.
Right. Let me ask you about a couple things additionally out in the field. You've mentioned this a bit, and that's humor.
Mm-hmm.
What role did humor play for you all?
Well, we just had some that were, in fact, we were laughing at, I've laughed at it since, but we had, some of the people were just characters that we had, and that I mentioned that Jay Montgomery, watching him step off of a helicopter with just a pack of cigarettes in his pocket, you know, out in the field because the first sergeant threw him on the bird. He was so mad at him. And that, to us, that was some funny stuff. We had a case where we had a big black fellow named Tate. I don't know where he came from, but he was right out of the hill somewhere back in the south. But he was probably 6'2" or 6'3" and just so shook up about being there. It was kind of sad, but we were, another time we were working close into the villages outside of Chu Lai, and a lot of times they would hook us up with, it would be our equivalent to a National Guard or an Army Reserve unit, but they would be South Vietnamese people, and we would do a joint kind of patrols and ambushes and things with them. Well, their heart wasn't in it, because I don't know if they were VC the next day or not, but one of these nights we were out there, and we were set up in one little area, and the counterparts, which we called PFs, I think, or Popular Forces people, were in another one. Well, again, the Vietnamese people all like to cook at night. Well, poor Tate is so shook up all the time that he heard them start to jabber and start to talk, and he started throwing his hand grenades at them. And they were screaming and hollering, and he threw, I think, 3 over there at these guys, because he thought the VC were coming at him. Well, it wasn't funny at the time, but the next day, we just, and to this day, I think it's the funniest thing to see him hollering and screaming and throwing hand grenades at these noises. Well, God, they were on our side, you know, the whole time. And thank God nobody got hurt. But, you know, we always laugh at Tate.
Mm-hmm.
Never got to see him since, but those are things. We had a case where we were walking through a canopy jungle one time, very, very small, and I think it was maybe just my squad, and there was a friend of mine, now I see a lot, named Culligan was one of us, but in fact, Tate was with us, and we were started in this thing, and all of a sudden a bat appears, and this bat's flying back and forth and back and forth, and pretty soon Tate runs out the back end of this canopy, and he's not going back in because he's so afraid of this bat. Well, but finally, this bat makes one more run trying to figure out what where he's at, and I baseball batting with the back of my rifle and knocking down. So we all go and stare at him a little while and kind of feel sorry for him and leave him alone. Nobody steps on him. We made sure he was going to be okay, but we all got around this teeny little bat that kind of put the fear into us. And again, in that kind of environment, the bat was, we were more afraid of the bat than I think having someone VC shoot at us at the time.
In the rear, did you all, what was the humor like back in the rear?
It was okay. We spent most of our time when we weren't working and drinking. You had the juicers and the dopers. I was more of, I guess, a juicer or a drinker. I like everybody else over there. You tried marijuana. But we spent most of our time in the EM club, and later on I became a buck sergeant or an NCO club, and just kind of hung out, in the clubs, listening to music, and just kind of like you would sit around with a bunch of friends in a tavern nowadays, and talk about what we're going to do and what we did do, and don't remember a whole lot of any special humor or any funny things that ever happened, back then. But,
Back in the rear, what did you all do for entertainment? I mean, you mentioned the drinking. What was that like as far as any kind of problem that you witnessed?
I don't really remember a lot of problems. We had the main problem. We get back. The main problem was, we had racial problems. But as far as the drinking goes, the a lot of the problems with the drugs that I saw there, a lot of the guys that got hooked on the drugs were just an absolute, they were a mess. I guess it was so cheap. And I think it was heroin is what they had, because a lot of these guys they would use Vicks inhalers, and they were always snorting this white powder. I was smart enough to ever do.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the alcohol, carried on for a lot of guys and caused a problem for them later in life, but it was pretty much a relief, for us. In fact, most of us, even when we were in the field, knew we were coming back in for a couple of days, all we thought about was just heading to the clubs, and start drinking beer, and we would drink it as long as they could, get it out there until they threw us out of these, old buildings is what they were.
Mm-hmm.
It was an escape from, where we were.
Tell me about riding home and contact with home.
I rode a lot, and then I got to see a lot as far as riding goes, is because I was, of course, there at the end was handling the mail, but I rode a lot home, wrote to everybody and anybody, so you could always get mail, especially in the field. You always wanted to get mail, and I can remember my dad, he's gone now, but I got all kinds of letters from him. They never ever said anything different, because I understand now there isn't really a whole lot different to write about every day, but he pretty much wrote at least every other day and didn't say much, but I was glad to get one. Got a lot from my mom, and they would probably just tell the same old mundane things that go on in everyday life, but it was nice to hear. I had cousins that would, we rode back and forth, and I had some real tight friends from high school that I knew, would write, and I'd write back and forth too. So, it was just something, it was just kind of fun to get mail. I had one thing I did do that worked out fine is that when we were in the field, they had an organization called the Blue Star Mothers of America.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had a person on their address, they'd send coffee cans full of cookies and fudge over, and if that person's name wasn't on it, it would just go to whoever, and they would send them out to the field. Well, early on when I was there, they sent one of those coffee cans out there, and the fellow was already gone. They had an address on it, so I took that coffee can label and I wrote a letter to him. And so, knowing that my name now was going to be on those coffee cans, so I think probably every couple of weeks, maybe, or maybe 3 weeks, I can't remember what it was, here would come a coffee can wrapped in brown paper, from the Blue Star Mothers of America, with cookies and stuff. And they'd been on the boat a while, because a lot of them got a little bit stale, but everybody liked them and everybody ate them. And I think it might have been 10 years ago or so when I first started kind of getting back into thinking about all this stuff. I stumbled on I don't know if it was a website. I think it was a website.
Mm-hmm.
But I sent a letter off to the Blue Star Mothers of America, thanking them and telling them, you know, what it experiences and how much it meant to me to get those things. And they sent me back one of their magazines from their national reunion. They had put my letter in and stuff, and just kind of, I just wanted them to know that what they, whether people said thank you all the time or not, and how much it meant. So I think it was very important to them. They got my letter about, you know, how important it was to me and all of our bunch for them sending those coffee cans and cookies over.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Were you able to keep up with what was happening back in the United States?
I don't think I even cared. I think, because I was never really into politics.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, or towards there, I was 19 years old. I didn't really care about anything except counting how many days I had left while I could get out of there. So I don't think I paid much attention to any of it. And, you know, about the only news we got anyway was we got the Stars and Stripes, you know, military magazine, mm-hmm. or military newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about all. And then the radio that, you know, you could get over there was Armed Forces Radio. So I think it was probably pretty well cleaned up from how bad things really were.
Yeah. What about the music? You just mentioned the radio.
Oh, yeah, I had a great time. In fact, I always carried a radio. I pretty much still always have since then. I still do as far as small transistor radio. But certain times of the day, we didn't have Adrian Cronauer because he's already gone, but we had the same DJs that played all the 60s music. And in fact, were you at the Adrian Cronauer reunion?
Yes, I was.
Okay, which was kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the music was important because, to me, the music was important in my high school days and at that time. And you figure, you know, music from the latter 60s and, say, 1970s, it was some pretty good stuff. So a lot of the floor shows, the bands that would show up, you know, one of our all-time favorites was The Animals, We Gotta Get Out of This Place. I mean, that was always banger we did in the seat. And I think it was The Temptations played My Girl. That was another one that everybody was kind of arm in arm and rocking back and forth and singing with the band. So music was fun. When we could get a live floor show going, it was a lot of fun. You know, and the radio was good, too.
Did everybody listen, or were the people who just simply kept to themselves and did their own thing?
I think everybody listened. I think if a radio was on, you'd sit around it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really recall anybody. Yeah, it was mainly it was something, because you could still have people send you over tapes. I think cassette tapes had just started to become popular. We had 8-track tapes before that, and I think cassette tapes were happening. So if somebody was lucky enough to have a little cassette recorder, then they sounded terrible, but we were able to do that. And then I can remember certain times of the day, they'd have certain radio shows on that would play certain 60s music. And I think they probably played other things than that, but I only paid attention to the 60s stuff.
Was this back when you were the mail clerk, or was this when you guys would stand down and go back to
school? That was both. Okay. Yeah, both. Because we would always have some kind of music going when we'd come back and stand down. That'd be going in the barracks or the hooches that we were in. There was always music going in the EM club. It's so noisy you probably couldn't hear it. And the floor shows, of course, they were all about music.
Mm-hmm.
And then even when I got to be the mail clerk there back in the rear, you know, I always had a radio hanging on the wall, and that was always going at that time.
Okay. Dave, why don't we go ahead and stop for today?
Okay.